Will the House please come to order? Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 80, respectfully returns with the recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne, signed and representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 91, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne, signed representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 132, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Patton, Throne, no, Gingrey, Peasley, Korberg, signed representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 120, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yeagy, Lubnow, McKim, McComey, Teeters, signed representing McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 54, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, no, Gilmore, Moniz, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom is referred House Bill 114, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Wanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 122, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Wanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom is referred House Joint Resolution 10, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Zwanitzer, Dan, no, Gilmore, signed Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 79, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stepson, Zwanitzer, Dave, signed Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 89, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Byrd, Kraft, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stepson, Zwanitzer, Dave, no, Brechtel, Harvey, signed Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom is referred House Bill 63, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Harvey, Kimball, Landon, Millen, no, Shepperson, excused, Hallinan, signed Representative Landon, Chairman.
Messages from the Senate.
Message 131, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 32, Wyoming Investment in Nursing Extension. Ayes 25, noes 5, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 132, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 36, Gillette Madison Water Project. Ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 133, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 56, Fuel Tax Bonds. Ayes 30, noes 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 134, Mr. Speaker, The bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 62, Veterans Burial. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Ina Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 135, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 64, Safety Belt Violations. Ayes 21, noes 9. Signed, Ina Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 136, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 69, Natural Resource Large Project Funding. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Ina Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 137, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 71, Disposal of Remains Military Personnel. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Ina Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 138. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 72, Wyoming Retirement Plan Contributions. Ayes 17, noes 13. Signed, Ina Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 139, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 76, State Loan and Investment Grants Criteria. Ayes 14, no 16. Signed, Ina Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 140, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 35, Tolling Authority for I-80. Ayes 18, noes 12. Signed, Ina Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
We're at that order of business of Senate files on first reading. First Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 9.
Senate File 9, introduced by the Judiciary.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to juvenile detention facilities.
Senate File 9 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 18.
Senate File 18, introduced by the Corporation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to limited liability companies.
Senate File 18 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 22.
Senate File 22, introduced by Transportation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the National Guard State Active Duty Medical Expense Reimbursement.
Senate File 22 is referred to Committee Number 8, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 26.
Senate File 26, introduced by Senator Case.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to crimes and offenses, eligibility, concealed weapons permit.
Senate File 26 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 31.
Senate File 31, introduced by Senator Bebout.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Federal Natural Resource Policy Account.
Senate File 31 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 37.
Senate File 37, introduced by the Select Water Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to water development projects.
Senate File 37 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 51.
Senate File 51, introduced by Senator Anderson.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to state symbols, official state code.
Senate File 51 is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 63.
Senate File 63, introduced by Senator Meyer.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to water irrigation districts assessments.
Senate File 63 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Representative Billaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Mr. Speaker, to all my fellow representatives, on your desk you are getting a CD that's entitled Code of the West. Alive and well in Wyoming. I attended the premiere in Laramie of this show and want to tell you that it's quite a CD, and I hope that you will all take time to look at it over the weekend. There is a bill, Senate File 51, that was just sent to Minerals Committee, and I don't know when they're going to meet. But the bill refers to Code of the West. And if you don't know, one of our body, is featured in this film, in this CD. And I won't tell you that she's wearing risque clothing. I won't tell you anything like that. But I will tell you that you need to find out who it is, and the only way you're going to find out who it is to see the CD. So I want you to look at it so that when the bill comes to the floor, we won't have any real discussions. So thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that item of business of consideration of bills on general file.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House resolve itself in the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Representative Byrd, come on up.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to be doing House Bill 106 first, and then House Joint Resolution 9, and then we're going to go to House Bill 72, 86, 69, 70, and 124.
Okay. Excuse me, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, a little housekeeping. I call the Committee of the Whole to order. And now can you repeat that list, please?
I absolutely would love to do that, Mr. Chairman. It's House Bill 106, House Joint Resolution 9, and then skip over 78 and 113, and then just pick up at 72 from there. And we'll be changing around a little bit today, so.
All right, thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 106, Representative, the reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 106, introduced by Representative Pedersen, an act relating to economic development regarding small business investment credit. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 106 do pass. With that, I would also move the Committee of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and I will leave the explanation of the bill and the amendment to the good representative from Cheyenne.
Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I'd start with a quick cleanup piece, and that is the standing committee amendment. And as the bringer of the bill, I was the bringer of the amendment. I got to use bringer twice. In on page 28, I'd like to show you what this means. On line 3, as you can see here, it inserts, the council shall transfer the fee to the state treasurer for deposit in the general fund. That just is just mapping the flow of it. And if you'd like, and it appears throughout the bill, it's just a cleanup. It's one that I missed. And you can look all the way down in the bottom of that page 28 where it says on line, beginning on line 20, it says the company shall transfer to the state treasurer for deposit into the general fund. And so it appears on that page. And that's just the flow that bills should have, because that's the way that money moves in the state. So with that, I'd call for the cleanup amendment, the question on the cleanup amendment 106, Standing Committee Amendment 1.
Question being called. You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready? You have already called the question. Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The ayes have it. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring before you the Wyoming Small Business Investment Credit Act. This is something that I've spoken with many of you about on the floor and met with each of you and gone over, and we saw it last year. I'd like to tell you a little bit about why the bill is important, again, remind you, and especially in this economic climate where traditional sources of funding aren't available for small businesses. Banks who have higher lending requirements by the Fed. Traditional venture capital firms are investing in much later stages of business growth. And what we're looking at is funding these new businesses in Wyoming, and what are those defined as? And that's why this is so important, is that this is a Wyoming-only bill for Wyoming-only companies. We're talking about in small companies with 100 or less employees, 60% of which are residents right here in Wyoming. They're doing business here and want to stay here. I also see this as a terrific opportunity to be pulling in immediate companies who want to move up from somewhere south of here, where it's nowhere near as nice as it is here in wonderful Wyoming, and they just moved 40 miles and moved their families and all these wonderful things. Based on, there have been 29 programs in 10 other states, and I think that that's one of the most important things, because when something works, it's repeated. And so you start to see this bill being done again and again because of its success, and not only creating that mid-level investment for firms, but also for creating jobs. One of our four-year universities did a study based on the other 29 programs that have gone through. And as I stated before, it would create 2,200 jobs at an average salary of $38,000. It's slightly below the 42 average for the nation, but it's still a great salary in a state that has a lower cost of living. And that's really the function of the job creation. How will we pick these small business venture companies? They will be done as, do they have a presence here in the state? Do they have 5 years in the industry? Are they willing to put in $500,000 of their own money so they have their own skin in the game? They have so you have the ability to have these people with a track record who want to put their own money into it and have a vested interest in seeing it grow. There's an average, and this is the part that I find the most exciting, of a 6-to-1 follow-along ratio. So by putting this in, we could leverage as much as 6 times as much. Venture capital companies tend to talk to other venture capital companies. They have a great deal here in Wyoming. Let's invest in this together. I've passed out to each of you a copy this is a black and white copy. Previous to this, you received a color copy that was attached to the letter, but this is the black and white one, and this is a really good summation of, and you did receive it yesterday when we were up. And this is a good summation of how we'll get $30 million today that's invested into these companies. And we begin paying back in 2014, $4.3 million a year over a 7-year time horizon from the premium tax credits collected from each of these insurance companies. And what we get is the time value of money on our side. And the other great thing about it is that it's a it promotes where you're looking at it, it's the best capitalism way to invest in your state, because all these venture capital companies can go out and look for these investments, but they all have to pitch it to the insurance companies. The insurance company will pick the best of the best. And so you have true capitalism driving this. It won't be picked through any buddy system or anything along these lines. The best will rise to the top, and that's how it will be funded. A couple of things I just wanted to finish up with. The ways that we're protected as a state is, one, is that if 25% of this isn't invested by X date, then we owe no premium taxes. 50% by a later date, we owe no premium taxes. If 100% of this is never invested, then we owe no premium taxes. We're never on the hook for that. And the other place is all of this investment is done, and it's done through a reinsurer. The Oracle of Omaha runs one of these. And so, worst case scenario, the Oracle of Omaha will come in, take over for the venture capital companies, and do the return, because they are the reinsurer to the insurance company, and they have guaranteed that rate of return. And so there are a series of steps that protect the state in all 29 programs in all 10 states. None have ever failed. I think that that's an important piece to know. I do stand for questions. I wanted to be brief because I've been so thorough with each of you prior to this, but yeah, I am open for as many questions as you have.
Thank you. Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Anderson's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 106 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Say no. The motion, House Bill 106 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution number 9. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Joint Resolution number 9, introduced by Representative Simpson, a joint resolution requesting Congress to cease and desist from enacting mandates that are beyond the enumerated powers granted to Congress by the United States Constitution, and to amend the 10th Amendment and the Interstate Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne, signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution 9 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I'll walk you through the Standing Committee Amendment real quick. It corresponds to just the other day we did another House Joint Resolution, and we made changes. These are almost identical changes. On the first page, instead of the word requesting, we have the word demanding. We took out today in 2010 because we wanted to be the document to be more timely or have perpetuity to it. Primary was just spelled wrong. It's supposed to be primarily. We took out a case name out, and then we put in there, we inserted not only Congress, but we said the Wyoming Congressional Delegation. And then lastly, we added a clause that requested that the Congressional Delegation of Wyoming take all reasonable and necessary actions to initiate the amendment process to amend the Constitution consistent with the language in the resolution. And if there's no questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, I would urge you to vote aye.
You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The ayes have it. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative and Speaker Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Joint Resolution 9, the resolution to amend the United States Constitution, Article 10 and Article 1, Section 8. You can see on page 5, 4 and 5 of the bill, the proposed amendments. Beginning at page 4, line 23, adding the word expressly prior to delegated in the 10th Amendment, and then adding another sentence at the end, that this amendment should be considered by all courts as a rule of interpretation and construction in any case involving an interpretation of any constitutional power claimed by the Congress. And then section 3 are the amendments to Article 1, Section 8, the Interstate Commerce Clause. The method of amendment of the Constitution, as I had stated on introduction, is not a constitutional convention. This is a request to Congress to adopt these changes by two-thirds vote in each House and then require three-quarters of the states to adopt these changes within 7 years. This is not just a simple resolution stating what we believe. This is a specific resolution stating how we believe the 10th Amendment and the Interstate Commerce Clause should be changed to make it clear to members of Congress, the executive branch, and the judicial branch of what the states, and specifically Wyoming, believes the 10th Amendment stands for in the Interstate Commerce Clause and how the Interstate Commerce Clause should be adopted. We believe that the 10th Amendment is relatively clear, but there, over many years of congressional action and court interpretation, it's our sense that let's go back and clarify and bring us back to a baseline where the states' rights mean something significant as they were intended to be interpreted, and certainly they weren't intended to be. You know, when you look back at the formation of this union and this country, those states were most important in developing the Constitution, writing the Constitution, and forming this government that now seems to have overtaken us in a large sense. So let's take a stand here and ask that Congress pass these amendments and go back to the original intent of Article 10, the 10th Amendment, and then the Interstate Commerce Clause. I stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number House Joint Resolution 009 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. House Joint Resolution 009 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 72. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 72, introduced by Representative Stubson, an act relating to siting and regulation of wind energy facilities. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 72 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments. This bill was a product of the Wind Task Force last summer. It was heard by the Minerals Committee in 2009 and again early in this session, and then processed through the committee. I'd like to turn the management of the bill over to the good legislator from Natrona County, who's dodging to his other desk, to explain the bill and the standing committee amendments, to both of them.
Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe to deal with the standing committee amendment first. this is really in the nature of a cleanup amendment that corrects a typo, and then on line page 14, line 10. In the referral provision that we'll talk about between counties and the Industrial Siting Act, it simply says that the director has the ability to accept those referrals or not, and that's a final decision. And again, it was intended to be that way. We just added some language to clarify that. So I'd take some questions or comments on the amendment, but maybe we can handle that right out of the chute.
Question being called. You've heard the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the? You are ready for the question. The question hasn't been called. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move standing committee amendment number two to House Bill 72. And ladies and gentlemen, what this has to do with regard is the employee, the full-time employee that's required to administer this project, regulating of wind with the industrial siting component. And as I had talked to you about earlier, what we have done is require the agency to use one of their vacant positions that we have reclassified, and that is what this amendment does. And it also is important for you to know is that this is considered an exception to the budget and that they will have to report back to us in the next 13-14 budget to report back on the successfulness of the program and the need for this employee. So if there are no questions on this, I'd ask for a favorable aye.
Question having been called, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 2 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The as some of you may recall, last year we had quite a bit of discussion about the environment in Wyoming for wind and the regulatory environment in particular. And as you may recall from those discussions, we had a situation where the Industrial Siting Council had some jurisdiction and review authority over some wind farms, but not others. The Public Service Commission had input and permitting authority over some wind farms, but not others. There were different kinds of wind companies. There were merchant wind companies that were not subjected to PSC review. There were utility companies that owned wind farms that were. You had counties that had regulations. You had counties that did not. And so what we attempted to do through the Wind Task Force is we talked with folks from all over the state, representatives of the counties, representatives of the state agencies involved, industry, landowners, to see what really was the framework for regulation of Wyoming or wind in Wyoming and what was working, what wasn't, where were there gaps, where did we need to fill gaps, or were there any gaps. And what we found was that there were, in fact, gaps between the various jurisdictions and the strong potential for inconsistency between those different regulating bodies when it came to wind farms. And so House Bill 72 seeks to address some of those gaps, and there is a companion bill on the Senate side, Senate File 66, which will come through and address another part of those gaps. But the bill really does essentially four things. It gives counties some basic authorities to ensure that they can deal with wind development within their borders, whether they have planning and zoning or whether they do not. It provides certain setbacks, minimum setbacks, that will apply to wind farms to protect, to ensure that neighboring property owners aren't unduly impacted by wind farms. And it includes this referral provision that I was talking about earlier, that in extraordinary circumstances, counties can refer certain projects to the Industrial Siting Council for review. And then finally, it sets forth the beginnings of a scheme for decommissioning and financial assurances. And this is to ensure that, you know, 30 years down the road or however long down the road we may be, when these turbines become obsolete, that there's some resource there to take them down and to ensure that we don't have, you know, rusting turbines across our landscape. There is a one-pager in your box if you want to look at it that I handed out that does walk through some of the key elements of the bill. But there's, I think, three sort of overarching themes to keep in mind. One is that these, for the most part, the standards and the provisions that are in this bill apply to all wind farms across the state. They apply to all counties, whether you have a current conditional use permit or planning and zoning permit process in place or not. They apply to projects no matter how big they are, whether they fall over the jurisdictional limit of the Industrial Siting Council or not, or down to the smallest wind farms, as long as they are industrial wind farms. And then finally, these are minimums, and this is a key policy decision that we made, is that there was some discussion and some urging that we adopt a statewide standard that all wind farms meet no matter what. We set minimums that and made the policy decision that counties should be able to do more if they wanted to, that counties should have the ability to steer this development in a way that made sense to their citizens. And we made that decision because there are particular impacts with respect to the siting of wind turbines that are very localized in nature, and we determine that local communities are in the best position to deal with those. And so that's why we set this as a minimum and not a maximum. Just to take a few minutes and try to briefly walk you through the bill. The first, you'll turn to page 3, 18.5502 is a new section, and this sets up really the framework of a new permit under county authority. It's a county wind permit. And if you already have a conditional use permit in your county that is used, this folds in. It's not an extra permit. It folds into the process that is already there. And so it is not duplicative and is not inconsistent with what is in place with counties that have already taken the steps to regulate wind. The meat of the county permit requirements are in 4, 5, and 6. 4, 5, 6, and 7, I'm sorry. And those requirements, like I say, they set forth a couple of basic tools that counties came to us and said, we need these to be able to deal with wind development. And, for example, it requires that notice be given to both neighboring landowners and to cities and towns when a company is planning to build a wind farm. It requires a wind developer to submit an emergency management plan to the county so that they can comment on it. It requires a waste management plan to be given to the county so that the county knows what kind of waste is going to be involved in these developments and what they need to do to prepare for it. And importantly, it also requires a developer to work with counties on county roads. If they're going to be using county roads to access a facility, it's going to cause severe damage to a county road. This gives counties the tools to say, to enter into agreements with wind developers to make sure that essentially the rest of the citizens of the county are held harmless by that development. There is also a provision within here requiring a site plan that's to be updated as you go through construction, and finally a site reclamation and decommissioning plan that has to be updated throughout the project. Knowing that these things change, it has to be updated every 5 years, and it's on file for citizens and governments alike to look at. If you flip over to 18.5504 on page 8, this gets into the second branch that I talked about, the setbacks that apply to these standards. And the way we reached these standards is we looked across the counties, saw what counties were doing already, and set a minimum that agreed with what counties were doing already and what most communities had decided made sense. And we have setbacks from adjacent property lines. We have setbacks from public roadways, from platted subdivisions, from nearby residential dwellings or occupied structures, and from cities and towns. And an important point to remember in this is that in certain of those circumstances, for example, the neighboring property lines and where you're near a residence, we gave the authority for developers and landowners to work together. And so those setbacks can be waived. And if you have a residence that's nearby an area you want to develop a wind farm, you can go to them, you can work with them, and either come up with an easement or some sort of agreement so that you can move closer to that residence than is allowed by the law. But it requires you to actually consider what that neighboring property owner's interests are and to incorporate those into your plan. The next significant part of the bill is the referral portion of the bill. And if you flip over to page 3, 18.5509 is the referral portion. And what this gets at is the extraordinary circumstance where a limited, maybe a small number of wind turbines has a big impact on either environmental concerns or socioeconomic concerns. And the examples I like to use, if you go up to my hometown, you can see 11 beautiful towers right in the middle of a residential area. And that was done because, frankly, our county had not figured out what they were doing on their own wind regulations yet. And it was a small enough development that they didn't have to go through industrial siting. There was no permitting whatsoever. And so you have remarkable impacts. If you go out and drive out one of those streets and look out somebody's porch up one of those towers, you see there's extraordinary impacts from that development that never got considered. And this allows a tool for those, in those extraordinary circumstances, they can be considered. And what has to happen is two things. First, the county commissioners have to make a finding that, yeah, there's a big impact on socioeconomic issues or environmental issues. And then the director of DEQ has to actually accept jurisdiction. And this is sort of a concept we reached to make sure that counties either weren't trying to avoid they're if they got into a sticky wicket, they weren't just trying to jump out of jurisdiction and send it to the ISC. And so the DEQ director can decide whether it makes sense for them to actually look at a project or not. The final element of the bill to pay some attention to is this concept of decommissioning and financial assurances. And again, this is right at the last few pages of the bill. And the way we decided to deal with this was through rulemaking for a couple of reasons. One is this is a very dynamic area of business, and things are changing rapidly. The industry as it stands now is very different than the way it will be in a year. And so rather than set very specific standards in statute, we thought it was more prudent to allow for a dynamic response to regulate it and to allow a rulemaking which could change and respond to the changing industry more readily. Another significant point about this area of the bill is that this is the one area where we said this is a state area of responsibility. And frankly, we did that in response to many of the counties who came to us and said, look, we don't have either the manpower or the expertise to be figuring out what bonds are sufficient or what letters of credit or how much financial security a company has. And really, they said, we don't want that responsibility. The state's in a much better position to address those issues. And so this is the one area where we said, yes, the state needs to be the primary area of regulation in deciding when these towers are taken down. And finally, just recognize that there's two portions of that statute. One is the financial assurances. Do you have enough money to take them down? And the other is the reclamation standards. So that is a sort of quick run through the bill, but I'd certainly be open for any questions that anybody may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question on page 3. On that lines 15 through 20, I understand the intent of not having dual permitting and agree with that. My only question is, and maybe I think I just need some more information to understand it more fully. It says no wind energy facility for which an application for a permit has been made or that has received findings of fact, conclusions, or an order from the ISC prior to July 1, 2010, shall be required to have the permit required by this section. Why is it that if an application is made, no application has to be made? If an application is made to the ISC, no application is required to the county, which triggers a lot of notice provisions to neighbors, and do you get that with the ISC notice or the application? And what happens if the application is pending for a significant period of time before the ISC? I'm assuming that nothing, that if there's an application with the ISC, then no construction could occur. Maybe you can just fill me in on it, because I think I'm missing something there. And I think that's all the questions I had on that section. Thanks.
Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good speaker points to a provision that really is aimed at those projects that are in process right now. And this provision simply says that if you've already filed your application with the ISC and you're in the middle of that project, you don't have to begin and ring the bell over again and go back to the counties and go through their process. There is some notice provision within the ISC. They are not as specific as contained in this statute, but it's simply saying, you know, this is going to start with those projects that come after July of this year.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also, for the body's information, just emphasize that ISC applications are in a very tight time frame. They don't linger once they're filed. The hearing in front of the ISC has to be held I think it's 90 days. But there is a specific, there's a time frame. Once an ISC application is filed, it doesn't linger. And all the local governments are given notice, along with a variety of state agencies.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few questions. On page 13 is where that referral section talks about, and how I understand it, if the Board of County Commissioners, if they find that significant adverse environmental, social, or economic issues are presented, so I guess they have to find that first, and then they have to find that either they don't have the expertise to consider it, or they don't have the authority to address. I was just curious what the first question was. I understand the expertise part. Which part would they not have authority to address? Because it seemed as though the rest of the bill, we were giving them the authority to address. I'm just curious what wouldn't they have authority to address? And then my bigger question is how this referral system works, because it looks like the county commissioners ask, or they request, that the ISC take the referral. The ISC can reject them. I think there's an amendment coming saying you can't appeal that. So they can reject you. But let's say they do take it. It says over on page 15 at the top that their decision is final, that once you refer it and they take it and they make a decision, that's final. But right in the middle of page 14 in subsection D, it says a referral shall not relieve the Board of County Commissioners from its obligation to consider the standards required by this article. So are there two different hearings going on at the same time? The ISC is going to do theirs, but then the BCC has got to go back and do a hearing of their own. I was just confused how that's going to play out.
Representative Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to stack up the questions too much on the presenter. I had a question on page 7. Concerning the lines 4 through 7, where they're certifying that there shall be no advertising on the towers, and wondered what the rationale for that was.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Take the questions in order. The authority that we're giving the county commissioners in this is not authority over socioeconomic issues or environmental, and that is intentional. We are not having them double up on what the ISC typically does. And so they have to make a finding that these are, I mean, the only authority they have under here is to do what we've said, which is to require those different plans and that sort of thing. And so when they do the referral, what happens is the county still goes through their permitting process. They are just simply saying there's another issue that a specific environmental or socioeconomic issue that the ISC needs to look at and maybe set a conditional conditions on the permit or something like that. And so the county keeps it, and the county does exactly what we say under the bill. And that's why it actually works very well with the ISC process, because even those big projects that are in front of the Industrial Siting Council, they still have to meet this requirement. And part of that is the ISC doesn't require some of the things we're requiring for counties here. And so it's a tool we're actually improving over the system now by giving counties tools that they don't even have when it's a very big, big wind farm. With respect to the advertising, that was another one of those sort of minimum standards that most of the counties had adopted, and so we elected to include within the bill. And it was sort of a consensus issue among the counties, and frankly, industry didn't scream too much about it, so there it is.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there are no further questions, I ask for a positive vote on... Oh, wait a minute. There is a committee of the whole amendment, and I think you'd be calling on Chairman Illaway after that.
Chairman Illaway? Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, back on this referral thing, just one more quick question. It says that the director may reject the referral. The director of the department may reject the referral. So then what happens? the county commissioners ask for the referral base because they lack the expertise to consider or authority to address the problems. And then what happens if the DEQ says, well, we're rejecting that referral, so where does that leave everybody in the process, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, then the process just continues as if the referral had never been made, and they go through their county permitting process, and it moves on. And so really, it really is a safety valve to ensure that the DEQ isn't getting involved in all sorts of projects that they shouldn't be involved in. And so they can make a determination, is this truly something that we should look at? And if it isn't, then it goes through the county process that we've set forth in here and moves forward.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 7, lines 19 through part of 21, this addresses the facilities not meeting the definition of a facility under the Industrial Siting Act. And it asks them to provide a detailed summary of, and I'm assuming this pretty closely matches the type of summary that's required, or at least some of the analysis required under the Industrial Siting Act, but provide a detailed summary of any significant adverse environmental, social, or economic effects that the proposed wind energy facility may have upon local governments, together with any preliminary plans developed to alleviate any of the adverse effects. Why simply local governments? Is that based on the language in the Industrial Siting Act, or was there any discussion of other impacts other than those on local governments?
Representative Stepson.
Mr. Chairman, I would say that is not necessarily by design to exclude other impacts, and if it's read as such, we probably should come with a second reading amendment to clarify that we're looking at the social, economic, and environmental effects of the project generally.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of referring to the area of on page 20, 21, in that area, I presume that this financial assurance for decommissioning is applicable to newly permitted turbines, after this goes into effect or some such thing. And I'm wondering what kind of leverage do we have on all these hundreds of turbines that are already out there? And I don't know. Did your committee study what the exposure is on this and who's responsible when they walk away from them? Whose dollars have to pay to decommission them?
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The decommissioning and financial assurances provision is separate from the permitting provisions. It is not intended to just apply to those facilities that are seeking permits down the road. It is intended to apply to all wind facilities within the state.
Representative Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just make this comment. A number of the wind developments thus far have been sponsored by regulated utilities, and they have in their process with the Public Service Commission the termination of the projects and the reclamation of the land. So it's in there even though they've been around for a number of years.
Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 72, if I could. Is that acceptable?
Yes. Representative Illouye, thank you.
Thank you. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 72. If you notice on page 9, in the middle of the page, it talks about constructing any tower or other structure, and this has to do with distance from places. And my amendment says to delete 1/4 mile and insert 110% of the maximum height of the tower, line, or other structure. And if you'll notice that they've 110% of the maximum height of the tower has been used on page 8 and 9, and these are the minimum standards for some of these items. Where this one is 110% of the tower from any platted subdivision. And if you remember what subdivisions looks like, in some cases subdivisions are platted and they may not have structures on those lots for a number of years or ever. And what we're trying to say is that to say a 1/4 mile from any platted subdivision probably is too far away. You do take up, in some areas, you do take up a lot of land where you could be having a tower. And the other thing is that in some cases, instead of a house, maybe it's a corral barn or something. But most generally, people that are building on platted subdivisions are not going to put their structure right on the subdivision line. So that's why we came back and said, looks to me like we're wasting some land where you could end up and put a tower or a tower closer. So we have said 110% of the maximum height of the tower, line, or other structure from any platted subdivision. So that's my amendment.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on page 12, line 8. Oh, excuse me, are we in the amendment?
Representative Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the amendment, I would agree with the bringer of the amendment that it does seem to be a little bit far for some of the listed items here, the underground structures, transmission lines, roadways, and that sort of thing. But as concerning the tower itself, I think that the 1/4 mile is a reasonable distance. One of the things that I've thought about with living close to a development like this would be, what would it be like to have a wind turbine circling in such a way that the shadow would foul across your house? And I think that you'd have this swipe. And I think it'd just drive you nuts. And so I would hope the body would resist the amendment and that the bringer would come back with another amendment that would leave the tower at that distance. The sun gets at quite a low angle in the winter, and that shadow is a long distance. And go ahead and allow these other structures to be closer. So on and against the amendment.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, I think the previous speaker brings a great suggestion. This is really the product of a delicate balance, because you cannot say that having a wind tower within 110% of the tower height of your platted subdivision is not going to impact your ability to sell those lots and your ability to develop that subdivision. So we are trying to reach a delicate balance between the rights of both the wind developer and their neighbors. And we felt at a minimum you needed to have that 1/4 mile space, because otherwise all you're doing is having a significant adverse impact on that person that went through the expense of subdividing that plot, and yet they have no recourse and no say about it. So I would urge you to vote down this amendment.
Representative Illouye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, well, if you take a look at page 8, it says, would locate the base of any tower distance of less than 110% of the maximum height of the tower from any property line contiguous or adjacent to the facility. Three little I says, would locate the base of any tower at a distance of less than 110% maximum height from any public right-of-way. Then you go down to little 5. It says, would locate the base of any tower at a distance of less than 1/4 mile from a residential dwelling or occupied structure unless waived in writing by the person holding title to the residential dwelling or occupied structure. Fine and dandy. We're talking about a platted subdivision. As I indicated, that subdivision may never be built on particular areas. We're talking about those subdivisions that, depending on, could be 35 acres, could be whatever size, but I think you're wasting a lot of land where you could be putting up a tower, and that's why I put it 110% from the tower from the platted subdivision.
Question being called. We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. All of those in favor of Committee of the Whole Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
The Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has failed. Is there any more other discussion on the bill? Representative Shepherdson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 72 and ask for your favorable consideration. First of all, I want to compliment the Wind Task Force. They did an awesome job of trying to maintain the balance of the developers and the landowners and the commissioners and everyone involved. So that's a really tough task, and kudos goes to them. My amendment merely makes I wanted to make a minor change, and hopefully it's minor with the way it's worded. It makes a change on page 7, line 13, that allows any landowners that's not the applicant to have a say in the decommissioning process. And the reason that was important to me is sometimes those roads are useful to the landowners. Sometimes the towers are useful. If they want to keep a road in existence, then they should be able to do that. Or if they want it completely reclaimed to its natural habitat, they should be able to do that. So this mainly just keeps them in the loop. It just says consulted in the development of the reclamation and decommissioning plan. It just keeps them in the loop. And I would hope if there's any questions, I'd stand for any questions, but hope you guys would consider this favorably. Thank you.
Representative Stepson.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a great amendment. I urge your adoption of it.
Question being called. We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The amendment is adopted. Is there any other discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Speaker Simpson.
Thank you. I have a question on page 12, lines 8 through 11. This says that the board shall grant a permit if it determines that the proposed wind energy facility complies with all standards properly adopted by the Board of County Commissioners and the standards required by this article. When I look back at 504 on page 8, this is titled Minimum Standards. And it talks about those adopted by the county and then these location, the setbacks. So those are the way I read it, those are the only standards you would have to meet. But when I look at the application under 18.5503 and what's required in the application, and specifically that On page 7 over to page 8, the detailed summary of significant adverse environmental, social, or economic effects. If you had a report saying that it was devastating, I don't think that's a standard that is referred to under on page 12. So if they meet the standards, you have to grant it. Is that the way you read it, or should what do you think about that?
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, the system was designed so that we kept the counties out of what they shouldn't be involved in, namely those complex socioeconomic and environmental issues that the Industrial Siding Council handles and is used to handling. And so the mechanism for dealing with those situations is referral to the Industrial Siding Council. The county doesn't have the authority under this bill to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down on a permit that may implicate those socioeconomic or environmental circumstances. Their authority under the bill is limited to those requirements in both 504 and 503, namely certification that it meets the minimum setbacks and that they've provided all those things and certified that all those things under 503 have been complied with. And so the mechanism for dealing with those other issues is the referral. This is designed to keep the counties out of those issues and designed to keep from dragging the counties into those issues.
Is there any more discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number 72 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. House Bill 72 has passed Committee of the Whole. Then the next bill for our consideration is House Bill 86. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 86, introduced by Representative Millen, an act relating to Medicaid, regarding Medicaid elderly care. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. No, Harvey. Excused, Hallinan and Kimball.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor first, right, before we start this bill?
Representative Millen, yes, you may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to let you all know that the Wyoming Nursing Association group is here. The Labor Health Committee spent lunch with them and talked to them about some of our bills, and please welcome them to the House.
Welcome to the People's House. You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Landon.
Mr. Chairman, before moving the bill, I just wanted to say this is a kind of a good moment for the nursing students, our their future of health care, to be here while we discuss this particular bill, which concerns Medicaid for elderly care. At that, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 86 do pass. There is a standing committee amendment, which I will cover at this time. The standing committee amendment makes some changes, mostly in wording. Some of the first changes that you can see is changing nursing home to a long-term care facility. Adding that not only is a physician to be reimbursed, but also other health care providers. Once again, talking about skilled nursing facilities. Then there is a change in percentages that you will see later on in the bill. That has to do with the percentages of Medicaid that will be reimbursed to a PACE organization. The state of Montana, or the state to the north of us, had a percentage of 95%. The state to the south of us had a percentage of 90%. We thought we could match that 90%, and that's the goal that you'll see in the bill. And finally, the last amendment just had to do with reporting. We not only wanted reporting of projected savings, we wanted reporting that actually had the historic actual amount of money that had been saved by having this program. So unless there's any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, I would ask for the question on that.
Representative Millen. You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Let me see. Question having been called, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Standing Committee Amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to pass over the explanation of the bill to the good professional nurse from the southeast corner of Wyoming.
Thank you, Chairman.
Representative Millen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman. I'm going to try to be just like my colleague here from Laramie County that tries to go through bills quickly because we have a lot to get on here. If you just look around here or talk to some of the nurses that are here, you'll know that Wyoming continues to be one of the fastest aging states in the U.S. The total population of Wyoming is projected to grow 36% in the next 10 years, while the 65-plus population is expected to grow by 111%. 62% of family caregivers in Wyoming said they need help now in taking care of their elderly parents. The history of the bill and why I bring this bill before you today is there was a community-based multi-partner work group that brought this to my attention after they had an assessment that showed we need to strengthen the care continuum for the frail elderly. Physicians and family caregivers explain problems with our current models. From we're being reactive, we wait until acute events like trigger care for a patient, that the system is fragmented. You know, some patients don't fit into the current care silos that we have. There's no incentives to control cost or utilization, which causes overlaps, repeated tests, medication errors, and there's also gaps in dental care and limits on home care. The work group had various people in it, from Alzheimer's groups to aging groups, our university's geriatric department, local physicians, and our local community hospital. The group focused its attention on the feasibility of adopting this PACE model that has already been well-tested through multiple demonstrations funded and conducted by CMS, which is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. CMS has awarded PACE permanent provider status, and the program now has been implemented in 29 states. Yesterday, we had passed out on your desk because this bill was coming up, and I hope that you still have it. It's a two-page on frequently asked questions about PACE and a one-page Wyoming PACE description. And so now what I'll do is walk you through the bill. On page two of the bill, in little a, it just says that PACE is an optional service that must be authorized by the state Medicaid plan. PACE would work within the existing Medicaid program. PACE has been successfully demonstrated since 1985 and has been given permanent provider status by CMS through the Balanced Budget Act. Little B says that PACE organizations have to be approved by the Department of Health, and then the Department of Health will contract with PACE providers to serve individuals. You have to be at least 55 years of age. You have to live in the defined service area that it would be, they will do reasonable transport within 40 miles from that service area. On line 13, it talks about that enrollees will go through a long-term 101 assessment done by usually public health nurses in Wyoming. And then you also have to be eligible for long-term care or nursing home services to be able to apply. Services available through the PACE organization are all necessary medical and related care, including physician and health provider visits, preventive care, medications, rehabilitation, home and personal care, transportation, hospitalization, and long-term care. These services are currently being contracted through existing community providers. And C, it just says the objectives of PACE are to provide a coordinated, well-integrated system as a Medicaid cost savings. that enhance the quality of life for frail elderly adults who choose to remain in their community as long as feasible under the coordinated care of a multidisciplinary care team. This team will prevent duplications of services. If you go on to page 3, we're getting into the rules that need to be developed through PACE. Little I just says you provide application procedures for organizations interested in becoming a provider. Then it talks about the reimbursement on the bottom of page 3 and on to page 4. And that's where the good chairman was telling you that we decided to go with a capitated rate of 90%, because that is what the state to the south of us does. The state to the north of us has a 95% fee. What that does is simply put, Wyoming Medicaid has X amount of dollars to pay for this population they must serve. And right now, state Medicaid pays a traditional fee for service for costs. But if you do it through PACE, it has a capitated rate at 90%. And so that's what they'll pay. And that's how you get your savings. Then on page 4, little 3, the Department of Health will govern the participants' application process for persons who want to enroll in the program to ensure that the materials used are understandable and everybody knows that when they get into this program, how it works, and then instead of having that fee for service, that they will be into this capitated fee plan. So the PACE program works within the existing Medicaid program. There's no new positions, no appropriation. As you go down to little e, PACE organizations can be public or private organizations. F says the organizations must demonstrate to the Department of Health evidence that they are solvent through a variety of documents, including insurance, reinsurance, cash reserves, and financial statements. Going on to page 5 and G, again, PACE assumes responsibility of all the costs generated by PACE participants and assumes all the risk. On H, the Department of Health approves the PACE program marketing materials used to inform potential eligible participants about the program. And that's required by CMS. In J, the Department of Health must amend their state plan indicating they will authorize the provision of a PACE in Wyoming and won't enter into contracts until a plan is approved by CMS. On page 6 and K, your PACE programs are not considered insurers or health management organizations. This is very standard in PACE legislation and in surrounding states. On M, the Department of Health reports back to the legislature on the implementation status of the programs. They will report on the quantity, the cost, efficiency, and then we amended into bill that we will see a historical annual actual cost savings in the next biennium that will show our projected savings from to Medicaid using the PACE program. Federal CMS regulations also require a higher level of performance accountability through reporting of patient outcomes. PACE programs must break even and become self-sufficient by 3 years. Down in N, PACE organizations are prohibited from withholding services to generate profits. They cannot hold back providing care to any patient that is enrolled. And on page 7 and O, individuals choosing PACE may disenroll at any time. That's in the federal PACE rules and a CMS requirement. And what we're going to do is, it was brought up in committee, we'll make sure that Medicaid rules will ensure that there are no penalties or adverse effects on their traditional fee-for-service eligibility. So if you disenroll, you go back to being on Medicaid with the regular fee-for-service. The fiscal note on the back, it does say we're going to get $1.2 million that it's going to save us that. That was based on having 388 patients. They did an assessment that showed that in Laramie County alone, we had 388 patients that could qualify for this program, and that's how they did the fiscal note. The program that wants to start here is really thinking they're only going to start with between 20 to 30 patients. So we're looking at the first year of it being more of a savings of around $300,000. Just a reminder that PACE would be open for private pay patients also to ensure the viability of the program. Certainly I recognize that we have wonderful programs for our seniors in hand, but this is just a resource that I feel that we need. It saves the state money. It's revenue neutral. I ask your favorable consideration. I vote on House Bill 86, and I stand for questions.
Representative Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, I was real glad that the representative covered the fiscal note, because we wanted to do a little truth in advertising here, and the fiscal note covered a lot larger population than what we anticipate the program will start up with. So just move a decimal place up and to get started, and that's what we hope the savings will be. The basically what we're looking at, one of the representatives pulled me aside a little bit and asked if I could just do a 10-second summary. That's impossible. I'll try to do as quick as I can. This is the PACE stands for Program for All-Inclusive Care of Elderly. And what it does is it changes the Medicaid model. Right now, if a person has an event happen, we are reactive. They go into the hospital. They might have to go into intensive care for 3 days before the Medicaid allows them to go into a lesser structured care environment. What these PACE organizations will be is they're going to be nonprofits. The ones that I think will probably most likely be the first one to start in the state is going to be out of the hospital here locally in this city. And they have a team of doctors and nurses, and they will contract with the state to manage the care of around 30 of those individuals. And that team will essentially manage the health care of people that ordinarily would be in nursing homes. They're going to try to keep them in their homes. They're going to try to deliver services in a proactive way, in a way that the team decides on what care these individuals most need. They get to know the individual. They get to provide personalized services, and they expect there will be less duplication of testing and the sort of things that happen in a reactive type situation. The funding then is what they do is they take an average of how much nursing home people cost them across the state, and they will provide this service for 90% of that average. And that's where the savings is to come in, is instead of buying services piecemeal for room and board at a nursing home and for respiratory care and for whatever they may need, is the PACE organization will provide all their care at that contracted price of 90% of the average of what it cost. And they also take on the risk at that point, too, in case that person becomes a high-cost individual. And one of the things that's really a part that had a lot of attraction to us is the PACE organization is not going to be able to back out of the contract, but if an individual who has chosen to be served by the PACE organization chooses to leave the PACE organization and go to a more traditional nursing home or another setting, they do have that freedom to do that. So what we're looking at basically is we're taking a system that has a lot of difficulties and we're trying something new that we think has the potential to provide better service for the individual at a lower cost.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions, I don't know anything about this, so I looked at PACE and I looked at it state by state as to who the providers were and what kinds of states they were. And I'd like to ask a few questions. It has helped the explanation that's been given. It looks to me like this is overall an authorization to proceed along this track for Wyoming. There was mention of service areas, and the example that was given, and the first example which would probably be put into effect, is here in a clear, distinctive population center. My question is, what does this do for the rural portion of our population, which is really the driver of costs in our healthcare system, the difficulty of providing services in a rural area? I just don't want us to go out of here saying that we've solved or addressed and attempted to solve the healthcare issues in this state. without including the rural portions of the state, which are the costly parts. And I guess my question, which someone can answer, I'm sure, are there providers now in the population centers, if you will, providing this sort of service with Medicaid reimbursements? I don't know that, but I guess I'd like to hear the answer to that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Landon.
Mr. Chairman, the testimony that we heard on that particular issue is the proponents of this have gone to some neighboring states to look at their programs. The PACE organization that seems to be working quite well in our area happens to be in a large metropolitan area north of where I live in the northern part of Wyoming that is kind of the health center for the southern state of to our north, for the southern part of that state. The it's likely that if we get started with a PACE organization within Wyoming that is advocated in this, it will start in metropolitan areas and get that critical mass. However, the one in the state north of us not only is serving a metropolitan area, but they also are serving the eastern rural area of that state. And the way they're able to do this is through their telehealth and telemedicine network. Is those individuals who are still able to live in their homes because services are being provided to them through the PACE organization, have interviews and have their health managed by local nurses and doctors who are in consultation with the specialist in the PACE organization back in the urban areas through telehealth and telemedicine. And so we see that model as one that we can transfer to Wyoming, but I don't think that that is going to be something that we'll see in the state for several years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jorgensen.
I thank Chairman Landon for that.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 86 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. House Bill 86 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Barbuto.
Mr. Chairman, privilege of the floor.
You may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the 60th. I just want to take a moment to recognize some folks up in the gallery today who came all the way from Rock Springs, Wyoming, braved the icy roads, blizzards, and wind, just so I could have some cookies, and I really appreciate that. Stan got some, too, and these are good cookies. I mean, these are really good cookies, and we're probably not going to share. But if you'll join me up in our left gallery, some old-time Rock Springers, Gail and Dave Aldred.
Welcome to the People's House. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, after House Bill 124, we'll do House Bill 93 and House Bill 113. And we'll change it after that, maybe.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 69. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 69, introduced by Representative Illaway, an act relating to elections, Secretary of State Directives Authority. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Kimball, Lebno, Miller, Stepson, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 69 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I'd like to turn it over to the good representative from House District 42 to explain the bill. Thank you very much.
Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This particular piece of legislation refers to the new Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act, which requires states to send absentee ballots to overseas voters at least 45 days before the next federal election, beginning with that held this fall in 2010. The new federal law also requires each state to designate at least one means of electronic communication, fax or email, to handle voter registration and absentee ballot applications, to provide election and voting information, and to send blank ballots overseas. If you notice on the bottom of page one, it talks about the Secretary of State is authorized to adopt rules and regulations. On page two, that ballots be available for uniformed and overseas citizen absentee voting act voters 45 days prior to the election. The rules and regulations on how ballots are to be transmitted electronically, how returned ballots shall be tabulated, and what information shall be provided to uniformed and overseas citizens absentee voting act voters will be done by the Secretary of State's office. So I ask for a positive vote on this House Bill 69.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 69 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. House Bill 69 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 70. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 70, introduced by Representative Pedersen, an act relating to taxation and revenue regarding vacant land. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Kimball, Lubno, Miller, Stepson, No, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that House Bill 70 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. This particular piece of legislation is rather interesting, but should not take us too long to discuss. It's an act relating to taxation and revenue, as it says, and it is necessary because of some problems with platted subdivisions. I will ask my good vice chairman from the Corporations Committee if he wants to explain the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment, and then there is a Committee of the Whole Amendment, which we'll explain shortly.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill concerns the assessment for vacant land in large subdivisions, development property. If maybe 300 lots, maybe 10 lots are sold under the directives that are coming from the state to the county assessors right now, if the 10 lots sold for X, then the other 290 lots are going to be sold assessed at the same price. It doesn't take into account the fact that it may take years and years and years to market these properties and build them out. So this bill attempts to address that, and it uses this thing in here called the absorption rate and goes through all that, which was borrowed from the state to the south. We went through on the Standing Committee Amendment, and we really deleted most of that and said that the assessor shall value the property through the use of present worth appraisal methodology upon request of the property owner. After some further consultation with the county assessor for this county, we have the Committee of the Whole Amendment number one of this, which would change shall to consider, so that it would say that the assessor shall consider the value of the property through use of the present worth appraisal methodology upon request of the property owner. We were just persuaded after talking to the assessor that we shouldn't use this hard language shall, which locks the assessor into one method, that there's more that needs to be taken into consideration, and that the proper terminology is consider, and that on the property that's been that gave rise to this problem, a county assessor would consider that methodology along with the others, but this would be the one that would be employed. And at this time, Mr. Chairman, I would move, let me see, the standing committee amendment's been moved, I think, and I'd move committee the whole amendment number one.
Let's vote on the standing committee amendment first, Mr. Chairman.
You're out of order on this. We're on the standing committee amendment number one.
Good. I call for the question.
Representative Simlek? Question being called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would move a committee of the whole amendment number one to House Bill 70 and ask for your favorable vote.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, what that does, as I said, is that changes the terminology and says that the county assessor, with respect to undeveloped land, undeveloped land in a platted subdivision that's going to be a long time coming to fruition in terms of sale, that they consider the value of the property through the use of present worth appraisal methodology upon request of the property owner. There is a determination from the state at the moment that they cannot even consider that methodology of appraisal, and the purpose of this is to provide a statutory authority for them to use that methodology. I'd stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask the good gentleman a question, and the word shall was probably in there to try and get some uniformity between counties. And was that part of the discussion when you talked to consider? Because now we've got a situation where different counties will handle it differently, and that's caused some consternation in the past.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I fully appreciate that question and the issue that's raised. And all I can say is we had shall in there, and we were persuaded by the assessor that we discussed it with, that made it too rigid and did not give them the flexibility. For instance, maybe you have 300 lots, 10 are sold, 5 are under contract, there's 5 more maybes, and then it goes out into the unknown about how long that's going to be valued. The assessor needs some flexibility to apply variations to the assessment values on those lots, considering on where they are and taking into consideration how long it might take to market them. And if we say shall use the present market methodology of assessment, we lock them into too rigid a formula, and they're not able to take into consideration all the variations. And so I don't like the variation and the potential for mischief very much myself, but I'm persuaded that the other way was probably worse.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know as an English major, consider has a certain meaning for me, but I'm sure that the law has a different meaning for it. Can you tell me exactly what the ramifications of the word consider are within the law?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the statute with me, but it's pretty much a literal reading. It's my English teacher's reading. Consider means don't ignore it. By the same token, you're not compelled to use it. It's somewhere in between. Take it into account and use it as appropriate.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From my understanding, currently the statute this bill is before us because of a case that went from the Board of Equalization up to the Supreme Court. I guess I would like to know why it's important we change the law before the Supreme Court has a chance to decide on the validity of the argument.
Representative Brown?
Well, Mr. Chairman, nobody knows what the Supreme Court's going to say, for one thing, and the Supreme Court is going to have to take into account a whole totality of things They're not going to talk to a county assessor and ask them what's best or what's needed to solve the problem. They're going to solve the problem that existed on the day the case was filed. And we don't know what that answer is going to be. We need some solution sooner than that. And we need to solve the problem and not decide a dispute between parties.
Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The amendment is adopted. Is there any more discussion on the bill? Representative Semlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern about this bill is not in the details that we just talked about with respect to these amendments. And my concern I will illustrate to you in this way. If you own property next to a platted subdivision, vacant land, and as you make those improvements to that vacant land, you're going to be assessed at fair market value for each of those improvements as you go along. There is a compelling fairness issue within this bill. If you're in the platted subdivision, you're doing the development, well, then you get a deduction for these improvements that you make over time. If you're right outside of that subdivision on your own land and you make those improvements, you're going to be assessed full market value. I think that's an inherent fairness issue. And it leads to another issue. This bill should come in the form of a constitutional amendment. In my opinion, effectively what we're doing here is kind of the same debate we had a couple days ago with the county option on reducing the assessed value of property. Let's go back and have just a real quick review of what the Constitution says in respect to the assessment of land in Wyoming in terms of being uniformity. All property except as in this Constitution otherwise provided shall be uniformly valued at its full value as defined by the legislature in the three classes. I won't go into that. Here's the important things. Item C and D under 97.15.11. The legislature shall not create new classes or subclasses or authorize any property to be assessed at a rate other than the rate set for the authorized classes. All taxation shall be equal and uniform within each class of property. Now, this bill doesn't, it has the effect of being in violation of that, in my opinion. So, you know, if you're going to develop land in Wyoming, that's great. If you're going to transition ag land or open spaces, let's just say, if you're going to transition open space land in Wyoming, then you better have a developmental plan in mind. Make sure it's going to work. If it's not going to work, don't go back and try to figure out how we can ask everybody else, particularly the counties. I just spent 2 hours during our break at noon with local government officials. They're very concerned about this type of erosion of their tax base. So, you know, if you're going to develop land Wyoming, that's fine. Make sure you got a plan. Make sure you can get it bailed out. If you don't get it bailed out, don't ask local governments, in this case, who are the beneficiaries of property taxes, to help pay that bill. So I really have some concerns about this, and I would just urge very much caution going forward with this.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, have those same concerns. We have declined to make more tiers in our constitutions about every time I've been down here at the legislature. This is a backdoor attempt, in my opinion, to do just that, to make another tier of taxation. Also, I think it probably is to face a problem that is probably unique in one or two places in Wyoming, and I don't think we should pass laws to that effect. I think, again, we just passed one that certainly would probably include in this is for land held for economic development. Let's kind of get it included in that if we're going to do it. But let's don't set up another tier in violation of the Constitution, and let's don't pass laws just for one or two incidences in the state.
Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we're talking about is subdivisions throughout the entire state. Subdivisions are platted And in a lot of cases, there are improvements and amenities and so forth, but the developer has gone to considerable time and expense to develop a subdivision, but he may only sell out of 100 lots or 300 lots or whatever, he may only sell five a year. We're not asking for an exemption. We're asking for the assessor to be able to consider how those are assessed. Fair market value, present worth. If you do fair market value, if I sell a particular lot to you and you pay, for instance, $50,000 for that lot, I don't think it's fair that you assess all 100 lots at $50,000 because you may only sell five. We're saying present worth. The present worth is what the present worth is on those undeveloped or unsold lots. So it is a difficult proposition, but we've got developers throughout the entire state, and some being in the Northwest County. A huge case was discussed by the man downstairs in his State of the State message that the State Board of Equalization appeared to make a ruling, and that case is going to the Supreme Court. There is another case in Northern Johnson County that is being litigated. This is not only in one particular county. This is throughout the entire state where platted subdivisions exist.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple of comments. I think I went over part of this too fast, and maybe I shouldn't have. With respect to constitutionality, appraisers have three common methods for appraising property, and they've been three common methods for 100 years. The comparable sales approach, the income approach, and the other one just left me, present value approach. The Department of Revenue gave a literal reading to the statute and went to the appraisers and said, of those three approaches, there's one that you will not use. There's no authority in the statutes for it, and that's the present value approach. That's why this says consider. They're using those three values on every piece of property that they do. It's not unconstitutional. It doesn't create tiers. It's not any new methodology involved in appraising. It is the fact that the Department of Revenue has deprived them of using one of the three approaches that are commonly used to appraise property, and what we're trying to do is put it back in. Now, I didn't like the case in one of our counties I know a lot about. The tax bill went up, it went so high that I said, you know, if that's going to be the result, then bankers are not going to loan on these developments anymore, because if they take that property back, it goes into what's called OREO, other real estate owned, and they already have to take 20% a year against earnings until they've depreciated it off the books. On top of that, if they come in there with some stupendous appraisal on it, they're just going to—the conclusion is just going to be that that property is not suitable collateral. And I don't think we want that to happen. So what we did is we went back and we're telling them, you may consider the present worth appraisal methodology when you're doing the appraisal. It doesn't mean, and had we left shall in there, I kind of think some of these arguments would have held water, that we are maybe de facto creating another tier in there, and it wouldn't be permissible. And that was another thought that went through my mind when I said, well, I think the assessor from this county was correct, and she prevailed on me to change shall to consider, so that it's just one of the same methods that they use to appraise all property.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, have some serious reservations about this. I question its constitutionality for reasons that have already been expressed. But what I really wanted to do at this point is to point out that there is already in law a way to deal with this exact situation that's been used as an example, and that is 34-12-106, vacation generally. So if you have a subdivision that's you've sold a few of the lots out of, but now it's in trouble because of the change of the economy and you have a bunch that you can't sell, then there's already a process in the law that says that you can any such plat may be vacated by the proprietors thereof at any time before the sale of the lots, and that that no plat or portion thereof where a permit has been obtained shall be vacated without the approval of the county commissioner. So all you have to do is go to your county commissioners and vacate the subdivision. It also states no municipal or county approval under this section shall be arbitrarily or unreasonably withheld. So there's already a process in the law. We don't need to be treading on these dangerous constitutional considerations. And I'd urge you to vote no. Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I don't consider that an acceptable solution. There are thousands, literally tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars involved in putting one of these developments together. And now you're going to say, well, if I can't market it within a reasonable period of time such that I can live with the values the assessor is going to put on it, I'll just go vacate the subdivision, which means once it's vacated, you'd have to start over and do it all again. It's just not, that's just not a solution. The other thing that proposed solution fails to take into account is exactly the one that the representative from House District 1 mentioned, and that is your neighbor may be the one who's doing the property improvement, and you're getting the problem with the assessment. And so what we need to do is empower the assessors to use the three accepted traditional methods of valuation and leave them go and do their work.
Representative Roscoe.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman, I would like to, all my arguments have been said already, but affirm what I heard from Representative, the good Chairman Anderson and the good Chairman Simlick. I do think that it would increase, would encourage more lots in our state, certainly not good for agriculture, and decrease the revenues for our towns and counties. Thank you.
Representative Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to take on the question of constitution. I have here a piece, and I can pass this out, and I'll make better copies for the floor as we move this bill through. The Wyoming Supreme Court has previously stated that there is an equal protection issue when taxation is applied outside of the classification provided for in the Constitution. The court cannot counter its constitutionality and deny de facto classification of property in its fashion for taxation purposes. Persuasive in this conclusion is not only clear in the criteria of the Constitution and the body of similar precedents in other jurisdictions, but also the 14th Amendment consideration of the United States Supreme Court and significant conclusion that equal protection defect results were clearly unequal application of taxation power as applied under state authority, which does not provide for the classification of taxpayers within the constitutional criteria. I also have two pieces of case law that have happened within the state of Wyoming where both went for the taxpayer, where we've previously already done this as far as having these really an essentially absorption and various other pieces with this. This is a needed bill, and we are merely codifying practice, and this is not unprecedented. We have a piece from the Supreme Court, the 14th Amendment, and past case law in the state that backs up this. We're merely just trying to, as I said, codify what was practiced before.
Representative Brown. Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the frustrations that I hear from taxpayers across the state is that our current system does not allow assessors to adequately reflect market value. All this bill does is give assessors the tool for these types of properties to assess the market value of the property, which is what all of our tax assessments are supposed to be based upon. It's not creating a new classification. It's not threatening local governments. It's allowing assessors the tools to assess market value, which is at the heart of our tax system. It's not some grand, glorious constitutional issue. It's about proper assessment of market value. I'd urge you to support the bill.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My observations over 30 years in this business of subdivision is that subdividers are in a business. They're in a market-driven business. And if they can't afford the carrying cost of what they do, they shouldn't make the bet. Now, I'll admit that recently we're in a flat situation, which will correct itself through the present methods of appraisal. And then maybe it'll resume the same upward slope. Maybe it won't. But when we start to interfere, the instant result of this, I believe, will be incredible pressure on appraisers and their county commissioners by some subdividers or some developers in various parts of the state. I think the fair thing to do is to stick with the direction that's been given to assessors. We've got 23 assessors. They're all different. They're all subject to different things. But if we get away from consistency based on sales, if you will, I think we're getting in trouble. Maybe there are no sales. Maybe there are no recent sales, but there will be at some point a sale. And that's what they base things on. So I urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe we can solve some of this if we just kind of reflect on what present worth assessment methods amount to. If you've got a piece of property that you expect to sell next month for $100,000, its present worth is essentially $100,000. If you've got a piece of property you expect you will sell in 10 years for $100,000, it's not worth $100,000 today. In other words, if you have your choice between a $100,000 piece of property that's available and will sell today as opposed to one that will sell 10 years from now, clearly the present worth of the one that's immediately sellable is worth more money than the one that's going to be sellable or will sell 10 years from now. All right, so how do you make them on an equal basis? You take what the cost of money is and you discount that $100,000 back through 10 years, and by today's present worth, it might be worth $80,000 because $80,000 is what today is worth $100,000 10 years from now. Why? Because you got the opportunity cost of money that you're not, you don't have availability of until 10 years from now. So you're not creating a new class by any means. You're not creating a new class. You're just creating and using the appropriate methodology for selling it or for assessing it. And it wouldn't be appropriate to use a method like comparable sales, because you're comparing sales that occur today with sales that are going to occur 10 years from now. They're not comparable. It's an inappropriate method. And all this is calling for is to use an appropriate methodology for the valuation of property that doesn't have a relevant value until 10 years from now. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add just one perspective that we haven't heard yet. I certainly appreciate the argument presented by the good representative from the other side of the Laramie Range, and I find that compelling. I might also point out to the body that this is not a new proposal. This same proposal went through this body not several days ago, but it concerned economic development organizations. And so now this is just making that same philosophy spread across to private development. The second argument that I would present would be, I think that this is a good policy for the people of the state of Wyoming. And the reason I would advocate that is, I think that it's good to have a large number of buildable lots being developed within the state, and that by differentiating the value in those lots and assigning those the greater value once it gets sold, is that keeps a lot of lots available on the market. And I would hate to see us go to a way where those were assessed at a very high value early, because either then the lots would almost have to be pre-sold in order to create a subdivision, or the cost of each lot would go up, and I would advocate also the supply would go down because the developers were not willing to go to the expense and risk of having that inventory. So on and for the bill.
Representative Brown.
Just one thing, Mr. Chairman. I heard the statement that we have 23 county assessors and they're all doing what they want, but here's the problem. A letter went out from the Department of Revenue that all 23 assessors had said you cannot use the present worth appraisal methodology when you appraise property. And so they have all stopped, and the apple cart is upset. And whatever the taxes were before, whatever you saw before, you're going to see again after this this passes. And this is not something new. All it does is restore and codify a practice that they were following until a letter came out from the state that said you can't do it. So it's not radical. It's not a big deal. And I was going to call for the question, but I see Mr. Speaker's up.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and in support of House Bill 70. Folks, in this climate of the economy and how hard it is to obtain funds for financing, whether you're a developer of a 40-lot subdivision or five lots or two lots, or you want to do whatever it is, certainly development requires economies, and there are reasons why people build out numbers of lots like they do. I mean, in Park County, if you want to develop a lot and you need water to get the financing, that's going to cost you a significant amount of money depending on how far you are from the domestic water line. That's one lot. But if you have three or four or five lots and all the neighbors around there can pony up and do it together, that's what you need to defer the cost. The comments from the gentleman from Buffalo and Sheridan, I agree with, that if we're talking about jobs and we're trying to create economic opportunity, it's hard to bring a business in when you can't find a house for your employees. And look at what has happened to us in the last 10 years just in terms of build-out of lots and construction and development and what it does for our communities. Those are great jobs, the vibrancy of our communities. So let's support an effort to acknowledge what had been done in the past, not shut it down. We have planning and zoning on the city and county level. They can address the issues of subdivision impacts and those types of things. But why do we stand in their way? So I support the bill.
Representative Simlek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and all due respect to the last speaker. The reason we want to stand in their way is because it's a fairness issue. If you want to develop those properties within a platted subdivision, you get this deduct. If you are own land next to it and you're not in a platted subdivision, you don't get that deduct. And my final comment would be, we talk about leveling the playing field all the time on this floor. And my good friend from House District 14, I've never won an argument with him in any debate. So it's, if you want to level the playing field, now's the time to do it. I ask you to vote no.
Representative Patton.
I'm not even on the 50-yard line with that one. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Having done a little of the development work, a couple of things that I can observe to you. A developer finds his profit lies in the last few lots that are available. Up in Thin Lynn, You're taking care of improvements, you're taking care of sewer, you're taking care of water, et cetera, except in the city. So I want to suggest that if this bill is not compatible with others' thoughts, we might consider really addressing how the cities in particular find revenue to support their basic services. In Pennsylvania, a long time ago, they came up with the idea that all lots had a proportionate share of the cost of general services. So the city council, mayor, police department, fire department were all there. By lot, they should pay each a proportionate share. So if this fails, if we can't go for something like this, we might consider something that maybe strikes the 50-yard line and is fair.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I know. But if this fails and the assessor cannot use the present worth appraisal methodology, then you're going to see a lot of weird things happening in appraisals compared to what you're used to in the past. This has only been in effect less than a year, and this bill would take it back and make it effective this year so that that's one of the methods they can consider. I'd strongly urge you passage of the bill.
Any other discussion? Question. All right. Question being called. All those in favor of, let me see where we are. Representative Illinois' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 70 do pass. Say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. House Bill 70 has passed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 124. Too late.
What?
Division is ruled out of order. We are on the next bill. Representative Millen.
Privilege of the floor, quick, please, since I spoke like a Easterner.
Yes.
On my bill and went through it so fast. I'd like to introduce the three wonderful people in my life that are up here in the North Gallery, Matthew 9 and Patrick 12, and my husband John. And they John and Patrick just returned from Lesotho, which is a country surrounded by South Africa. They went in a cataract mission for the last week, and you'll have to talk to them about their stories of rats and cockroaches in the operating room there.
Welcome home. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 124, introduced by Representative Brown, an act relating to liens. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Kimball, Lubnow, Miller, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 124 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and the good gentleman from across the hill will explain the bill.
Mr. Chairman, this issue came up in our committee meeting, and we just went and had a bill drafted to fix the problem. On real estate liens for contractors, real estate improvements, all that sort of thing, the lien claimant files a statement with the county clerk and mails the notice to everyone that's supposed to get a notice. This bill has to do with another kind of lien on mines, quarries, gas, and other wells. In that case, the lien claimant files a lien statement with the county clerk the same way the other lien claimant does. But then the statute says the county clerk will mail the notice. The county clerks came to us and asked us to give them some relief on the postage. Some of these oil and gas liens can have 100 parties in them that have to be noticed. They wanted relief on the postage. We looked at this and said, well, why are we even doing this at all? So what this would do is conform oil and gas and mineral liens in general to all other kinds of liens and say they're all treated the same way. The claimant files the notice or files the lien with the clerk, and the claimant mails the notice. And let's get the county clerk out of that business. And I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Illoway's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 124 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. No. House Bill 124 has passed the House. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 93. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 93, introduced by Representative Throne, an act relating to the Wyoming Occupational Health and Safety Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, No, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 93 do pass. And I'd like to turn the explanation of this over to the good legislator from House District 11 to explain the bill.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, both. Today I bring you House Bill 93, a bill recommended by a workplace safety task force that resulted from discussions that began last year. Wyoming is in the unenviable position of having a workplace fatality rate that is 4 times the national average. Both this body and the Office of the Governor felt it was necessary to convene a task force to look at the reasons for workplace fatalities in the state of Wyoming. It was a broad-based task force composed of representatives of our OSHA agency, representatives of transportation, the oil and gas industry, the contracting industry, as well as representatives of labor. They came up with many recommendations, and certainly there is not one single fix to our workplace safety concerns in Wyoming. But this task force recommended an increase in OSHA penalties to match pending federal legislation. In addition, Wyoming OSHA is partnering with our oil and gas operators to provide courtesy inspections. These recommendations are also based on data looking at the lack of civil enforcement. In the enforcement world, whether it's law enforcement or regulatory enforcement, it's necessary to have carrots and sticks. And in Wyoming, our carrots are kind of big and our sticks are kind of small. The workplace safety OSHA penalties have not been increased in years, and we have had some fatalities in the oil and gas patch that have resulted in embarrassingly low penalties. For example, according to information I've received from OSHA, there was a penalty assessed in a fatality of only $5,000. I think you can kill a moose out of season and risk a higher penalty. I know personally that you can have a minor air quality violation and face a more significant penalty. We are not valuing our workers. And this is supported by business. And the reason it's supported by business is that companies who play by the rules and take care of their workers want to see those companies that don't have an incentive to clean up their act. OSHA has an extensive compliance consultation process where you can go in voluntarily and basically get a free inspection with no enforcement risk to correct your problems. We need to value workers in Wyoming. We need to have incentives and deterrence in place to ensure that the basic safety regulations designed to prevent serious injury that then leads to workers' comp expense, and more importantly, to deter and prevent serious injury that leads to fatalities. We need those deterrents in place to ensure a good business climate and a good workplace climate. And I would stand for questions.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was one of the no votes in our committee on this bill, and I'm remaining a no vote. But I don't want this to be perceived as not caring about employee safety. I very much, in fact, I was one of two legislators that ever attended any of these task force meetings because I care considerably about patient, about worker safety. But I have to tell you that I don't believe that this is the best way to attack this problem. I think that the task force in and of itself has been an excellent tool to raise awareness, to enlist industry, to help people figure out the solutions. They've helped to quantify what the problem is. They've identified that most of the fatalities are actually in the transportation area. And I'm not saying that one death in the oil and gas field is not important. That is very true. They are very important workers. But my voice today is for those small employers that didn't take time off to participate in the task force. They didn't because they're just struggling to keep their businesses going. They're struggling in my area just to keep their employees hired. And it seems to me that if we're looking at all the tools available to tackle this problem, that we have chosen a sledgehammer to come down on the companies. There are several things that I think are inherently wrong with this bill, and the first one is that there's no assignment for blame. If an employer buys a grinder with a guard and installs it, and an employee decides that he can't quite do his work how he would like to or efficiently, or he can't quite reach to grind this one little corner, and then he removes the guard, OSHA comes in, but who gets the fine? It's the employer. So there's no assignment of whose fault is it that the safety equipment wasn't in place. It was just the employer's fault, and then he faces the consequences. The second thing that I think is wrong with this is that the fines don't match up with our workers' compensation awards for death. We're bringing some of these fines up to a tremendous level to benefit the schools. But what about the families? Sometimes companies do take care of families. Sometimes things can happen that the employers, through their generosity and through their care of the worker, and we're removing their ability to do so, particularly small employers. I think that this is a little bit, I think this is a lot exaggerated consequence. I think that awareness is the first thing that we need to do. I think education is the second thing we need to do. I think that the fact that OSHA has signed up to help do inspections without fines in the beginning to help people get their workplaces up to safety standards, I think all of those things are excellent. But that's not where we're starting. We're starting with increasing the fines, a very large portion. We're taking a sledgehammer to a task that may only require a chisel. And I would just urge you to think carefully about this bill and the consequences, particularly on those small businessmen who work hard to keep 10, 15, 30 jobs in a community. A lot of our communities do not have large manufacturers. They do not have the dollars and the backing of very large corporations that allow them to cover these fines and still recover in their business. So I would just urge caution and let you know that I'm still a no vote on this bill.
Representative Throne. Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is one of those situations in which you, in many respects, hope you wouldn't find yourself, and that is that you intimately know the details of how our current laws really, really work. I'm sure many of you have heard the my explanation of our dear family friend who was killed in the oil patch the first year I was elected. And this young man was a senior in math at the University of Wyoming. And this is how our system works. He was killed on a rig. There were multiple factors in the rig why the accident occurred. It takes a year for OSHA to investigate it. So the family waited for a year. And then I read the OSHA report, and I would recommend that you all do. The company was fined $500. And they were told to please clean up the way that they were doing things. And, of course, they promised we will change the way we do things. But amazingly, within another year, another one of their employees was killed in the workplace. Now, let's go back to the allegation that these companies help the families. Let me tell you how it really worked in this situation. Because he was a young adult, the parents, when they got word that he had died, didn't know. Did he have insurance? His car's down there. He was just doing summer employment to pay his way through college. And so they called the company. And the company said, we can't talk to you. Every phone call was returned with, we can't talk to you. The first time the company talked to the parents was when they stood in front of me in the receiving line at the funeral to extend their hands and say, we're with XYZ company and we're terribly sorry. We'll pay for the coffin. That is how it works in Wyoming. And so when I've been watching this the last few years and everybody say, these accidents happen because of the transportation problems of getting back and forth to the job, well, that does happen. But in fact, people have died in Wyoming because of industrial accidents. So when I've talked to the various mineral companies that I know, the very large ones are horrified. They operate all over the world. Safety is their number one concern, and they are very proud of their records. And, in fact, it is the smaller companies that are the ones that are having the accidents. And the question becomes, how do you get their attention? That in Wyoming, a safe workplace is an inherent right of the worker, that we do not want people to be killed in our workplaces because we don't want any more young men that are taking high-risk jobs in the summertime to pay for their college to give their lives because of a falsely put together rig. And so the bill before you, I leave to you to determine by yourself, but I want to tell you how the current system works from my personal experience. Those are the facts of our current system.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've spent 50 years in the industrial sector, and it has been primarily large corporations and large operations. And what you just heard from the last speaker is accurate, is safety was a number one issue. And when you look at some of the records that we have in Wyoming on the mining sector, we have the largest mine in the world, and it went 4 million hours without one lost time accident. The facts are small accidents, if you ignore them, they get to be bigger accidents, so you've got to have a culture all the way through the organization. Now, we heard on the presentation before the committee that other industries have had a different kind of an approach. Safety was high at the top, but as you drill down into the organization, it wasn't followed as completely as it should have been, and a commitment from those organizations, as they worked with this task force, was to try to drive down the interest at the lower levels within the organizations. They tended to be smaller, but not always very small, but smaller than the ones I've experienced. That said, I think this is a good bill. I urge your support of it, because I think safety is a very big thing for our state. It's for our industries, big and small, to do it right. And I think there was a task force that committed to it, and I think they've come up with a good solution. And there is a carrot and stick in this thing. The carrot is you got good employees, they're there, they do the job. That's the carrot. The stick is if you don't treat them right, don't provide the right safety training and safety practices, there's going to be some consequences of that. So I'd urge your support of the bill.
Representative Throne. Representative Bagby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is about families. Higher fines keep workers safe because employers are more apt to follow stringent safety rules. If they know they're going to get fined, they're going to be out there inspecting. And they're going to put safety issues in place and make sure that they follow them, because they don't want to get fined. So it's going to help safety, and it's going to help young families. It's just tragic when a young father gets killed out there on one of those rigs. It's tragic for the whole family. It's tragic for the kids. Look at the kids they leave behind. One thing that got me when I listened to some of the testimony on this was Wyoming has the highest accident rate, or one of the highest accident rates in the U.S. Why is that? It's got to be a reason why these workers, it's more than seatbelts. It's safety. It's on-the-job safety. And, ladies and gentlemen, I think we can do better than this. Thank you.
Representative Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Being one of the very few in the Wyoming legislature, as one of those small company employers, I've signed on to this bill, and I'm going to tell you why. There are several key phrases and words in the bill, if you'll take a look at it. Page 1 says willfully and knowingly. If you do something so egregious and somebody gets injured because of it, or somebody gets fatally injured because of it, shouldn't there be some consequence from that? Page 2, you can also note there is some relief should somebody prove a case. It does say down in there, provided that a lesser penalty may be imposed by the commission. As mentioned, business in general would support this. Of course they would. Why wouldn't they? You know, I'll tell you why they would. In general, those that are doing things responsibly to get rid of the bad actors, those that apples in the barrel that are spoiling it for the rest of the people that are doing a good job. Get them out of business if that's what it takes to do, what it takes to get them out of business, and because they will continue to do it if allowed to do it. When I read articles in the paper and watch television and hear things on the radio, another article that says, here we have another oil field fatality. I'm going to tell you, as a member of that particular industry, it hurts. Because, you know, I do things, I believe, incredibly responsibly. But yet, when that bad apple in that barrel does something, and does something stupid, and did it in such a way that they had some responsibility in it, willful and knowingly, then somehow or another I get the sting of that bee as well. The entire community, the entire oil field community, or the entire mining community, or the entire construction industry suffers a black eye. And how responsible is that? Because you have literally 85 or 90 or 95 or 99% of the people doing an incredibly good job. Those businesses struggling, they know right from wrong. They know what they must do. It's as the things that we're born with, we know right from wrong. When you're in business, you know right from wrong. It simply is not that difficult to put things into place, to be safe. When you do something egregiously, when you do something willfully and knowingly and somebody gets hurt, should you not pay the price? If you're in business and you employ people in this state and in those industries where people are at some sense of risk, some high element of risk, you owe them a responsibility. You owe them. You ensure as safe a workplace as possible that you can for them. Otherwise, why would you want to be in business? Can you simply cover everything? No, that's not possible, or would people get hurt, injured, or fatally injured? But you can make, how does this happen? You can make your workplace as safe as you possibly can to the limits that you all have. Common sense of an employer, showing the care and responsibility that comes with the job. That's part of the job of being an ownership and a proud member of an industry that has done so much for the state of Wyoming. Testimony I heard this summer before a joint judiciary in one visit that I made indicated that by several people testifying to the issue of duty of care to employees of subcontractors. What I heard there from some of the folks that have had families that were affected by it was that by allowing lawsuits on employees of subcontractors would generate awards that would ensure compliance. Well, if what they're saying is to be believed and is to be true, then that perhaps should not the size of the hammer be a little bit bigger, should not the weight of that hammer be a little bit larger, so that the employers that know better, that know that they must institute easily instilled programs and easily instilled safety procedures with their employees. It is not that difficult. It is not that difficult. So in the cases of willful and knowingly, where there is shown to be a without doubt, a lack of care and a lack of responsibility, should that not come down a little bit hard, or matter of fact, a whole lot hard on those people, because they are the bad apple in an entire barrel, and that's a big barrel, and it's a lot of good people. Safety isn't just a big thing. It's the first thing, and it often becomes the only thing.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the good chairman of revenue and my friend who sits across the aisle from me, as well as the good chairman of judiciary, have made a strong case for this bill. I want to let the body know that OSHA penalties have not increased since 1984. I was not even in law school in 1984, and I've been practicing for over 20 years. The fines have not increased since 1984. In addition, the good chairman of judiciary mentioned that we have a pretty good mine safety record in this state. And the reason we have a good mine safety record, one of the reasons we have a good mine safety record in this state, is that mines are regulated by MSHA, a different agency with substantially higher penalty authority. Penalties are part of the puzzle. They're not the cure. There are protections in the OSHA program for small business. And as the good chairman of revenue said, employers have a responsibility. And as the good friend from the Bighorn Basin said, we don't want our young men spending their summer jobs, earning money, and losing their lives. Thank you.
Do I hear the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole arise to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 93 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. House Bill 93 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 113. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 113, introduced by Representative Korberg, an act relating to concealed weapons.
You have heard
this. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Peasley, Korberg. No, Barbudo, Patton, excused, Throne.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Oh, thank you. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 113 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. The Standing Committee Amendment, what it does, we just inadvertently, when the bill was drafted, left out two things. All this, the structure of the bill is pretty easy to understand. What the structure is, we have concealed weapons permits already in the state, and there's a list of things
that you can't do to get a permit. And all this bill does is it repeats all those same requirements with the exception of training. And we had just inadvertently left out two of them, not currently adjudicated to be legally incompetent and not have been committed to a mental institution, and those had to get put back in. And then we also worked on subsection B on page 3 is the section dealing where they have an interaction with a peace officer. We had in their question and addressed and the word contact, and those actually weren't the correct words to be using. It needed to be stopped or detained, which is a higher standard. And so we put that throughout that paragraph. But that was the Standing Committee amendments, and I would urge your aye vote on the Standing Committee amendment.
You've heard the motion of the Standing Committee amendment. Ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Gendry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. Real simple amendment. When we were changing things in committee, we forgot to take out one little clause on page 3, line 15, and to make it grammatically work, that between the person and the peace officer needs to come out. So I would ask for your aye vote on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 has been adopted. Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this body has been an advocate of individual rights in this state. We've seen that time and time again. I visited with you about that upon introduction. This bill received good support on introduction, and I ask again for your support to move this bill through Committee of the Whole. This bill, it's a Wyoming bill, and it's a bill for Wyoming citizens. And it basically restores a right that I think government has infringed upon over the years. And basically, this bill would allow Wyoming citizens within our own borders to carry a firearm concealed. There's nothing that's the essence of the bill. As the good chairman of Judiciary explained, there are some prerequisites for allowing you to carry, and those are identical to carrying with a permit, with the exception of training. The only other part of the bill, the only other section in this statute, in this piece of legislation, that there's another piece, obviously, a subsection B. And that merely says that if a peace officer approaches you, stops you, or detains you, he can ask you if you are carrying a concealed firearm, and you have an obligation to tell him yes or no. And then it does not say the peace officer shall. It does not make it mandatory. It merely says that if he determines that it's necessary for his own safety or for someone else that's present, he can ask you to secure, he can either secure the firearm for you or he can direct you to secure it. It's just that simple. It's a very simple process. It does not say that it's mandatory that he ask you. It says he can ask you and you have to respond. And that is very, actually very similar to carry concealed with a permit. A peace officer can ask you if you are carrying concealed with a permit and you have to answer yes or no. So these two pieces of legislation are very similar. And they simply go on to say you can't carry this weapon concealed anywhere, you can't carry it with a permit. So the same restrictions apply. You can't carry it if you have a permit. There's certain places you can't carry, and the same restrictions apply if you're carrying without a permit. So the bill mirrors almost carrying with a permit. It does keep in place carrying with a permit, because understand, if you are permitted, you have reciprocity in other states. So there's an advantage to being permitted. But what the essence of this bill, in my opinion, is it restores a right that we have taken away from the law-abiding citizens of the state of Wyoming, and that's to carry a firearm concealed. And I would stand for any questions.
Representative Barbuto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to stand today in opposition of House Bill 113. Up in committee, a lot of the testimony we heard was, this bill's good for law enforcement. You're going to be able to be there to back up law enforcement. This is going to benefit the safety of Wyoming citizens. Well, I'll tell you, I haven't talked to a law enforcement official or officer yet who likes this bill. In fact, they've all told me they don't want this bill. And there's a few reasons. I'm going to go over some of those. First of all, just because a person has a concealed weapon, they don't always divulge that information to an officer when the officer stops them for a traffic stop or on the street or whatever, whatever that detention may be for. Sometimes this is on purpose. The person is willfully withholding that information. Sometimes it's an accident. They're forgetful. What this current process has is the permit. So when that officer takes the license back to the car, well, I want to point out first, we all know an officer approaches every situation like a person has a gun. That's just good practice. But when they go back to the car, dispatch can say to them, hey, by the way, this person has a concealed permit if they haven't said anything. So now that changes the whole game. It goes from assuming that they have a weapon to there's really a good chance that they do because they hold this permit. Another question that comes into play is this question of something that's referred to, and I guess I don't know if I can refer to it here by its proper name, but it's called the Terry Frisk. Now, what a Terry Frisk is this is what the Supreme Court has said, and I know that a lot of lawyers are going to stand up probably after I say this, and remember, I'm not a lawyer, not even a simple country lawyer, so be kind to me. But the way I understand it, if as a person, if the cop or the officer can articulate that this person has a firearm on them, they have the right to pat down that person, or at least go up and ask, do you have a permit for that this weapon, and or then proceed with the pat down. Now, what scenario is it's an August day, a man is standing in front of a bank in a long trench coat, and it's obvious that he has a firearm under that trench coat. Can the officer go and pat him down under this? I don't know. I don't know if that officer has the right. So that man shoots somebody or robs the bank. Well, whose face does that mud land on? I'm afraid it's going to land on the peace officers because his hands were tied in this situation. She talked a little bit, the good representative from Hot Springs County talked a little bit about some of the exemptions. If you've been institutionalized for mental illness or a substance and alcohol abuse problem, or if you've been convicted previously of a crime, you are not eligible to carry a concealed weapon. Well, that's fine, except there are people out there who maybe need to be institutionalized or maybe should be, maybe they have some criminal tendencies that need to be looked at. Now you're taking out the only point of contact between them and that gun, and that's the sheriff or the police chief or whoever issues that permit finally. And we all know our sheriffs know people in their community pretty well, and they can read people pretty well in most cases. And I think it's important to leave that in there. There are rights come with a certain extent of accountability. If I go to vote, I have to register. Voting is my right, but I have to register. I just can't go vote. Otherwise, I'd go vote several times. I would have won by a lot more if that was the case. I went and got married recently. I didn't just go get married. I had to go and buy a marriage license. So even though I think marriage is a right, I had to be accountable to the government and buy a license to marry my wife. Another thing I want to bring up is that, and I thought actually that the permitting process was a lot more difficult than it is. But actually, the chairman of our committee filled me in on it, and a helpful highway patrolman the other night, that you go, you do your background check, your fingerprints, you pay $60, and for the good chairman of judiciary, it was a 30-day turnaround. For the highway patrolman, he said he got it in about 2 weeks. He said it was equatable to the time it took him to get his driver's license. I just think in the end, taking into account all those things and knowing what we know, voting yes to this piece of legislation doesn't strengthen our Second Amendment rights any more than the current law has weakened them. If you haven't talked to your law enforcement officials, I'd in your counties or your cities, I do recommend that you talk to them before you vote yes on this bill. Oh, you won't have the chance today, but should it make it to second and third reading, talk to them. See what they think. I think it's going to be eye-opening for you, and I rest my case.
Representative Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I question the need for this bill, even though I'm leaning towards voting for it. I have a question for the bringer. It says, be at least 21 years of age. Well, I was carrying an M14 before I was 21. And as far as the permit process now, I can escape that by just bringing my DD-214 down to the sheriff's office. I don't have to have any training. He will accept my military training as a good enough example that I know how to handle a firearm. I have one other question. I have a brother-in-law with cerebral palsy, and he carries a gun, and according to this, he might not be eligible anymore because someone's going to determine that he's not physically fit because he has a bit of a shake, and he's very physically fit. And to also the representative from 48 to answer that, I've been lobbied pretty heavily by the chiefs of police, and they hate this. And even though I'm a real gun advocate, I own a lot of guns, I just question the even need for this bill.
Representative McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I happen to have two law enforcement people in my family, one of my sons and my brother. And I called and talked to them about this bill, and because I told them, I said, I think everybody in Wyoming has a right to carry a concealed weapon. They told me that the biggest concern that they have with this bill, because the criminals aren't going to carry, they're not going to get a permit, concealed carry permit, and they're going to be out there anyway, is the fact that when they come across somebody through whatever, and they've got a concealed carry permit, I mean, they don't have a concealed carry permit, but they have a concealed weapon, whether it's a gun, whether it's a knife, that's defined in our statutes. They feel they're compelled to run an NCIC or the other, I forget what the other two systems that are used, to check on the backgrounds to see of these individuals, to see if they are a felon or they are one of the other descriptions in the bill. Because if they are, they're in violation of the law, and that's what they're supposed to do. So this is going to detain people who are probably going to be unhappy, especially if they are, like everybody in this body, I know we're all upstanding citizens, and it's going to take up more of your officers' time. But that was their biggest concern with the bill. Thank you.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of committee of the whole amendments. Would you prefer to hear them now or later?
At your leisure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee of the whole amendment number 2 to House Bill 113. I would ask for your favorable consideration. Ladies and gentlemen, what we're doing now is allowing everybody to carry a gun, and I think that's fine. But I now worry about the folks that really are not comfortable with everybody carrying a gun. And those concerns, so this amendment addresses that. It basically says that if you're a property owner or a business owner, or I suppose it could go on to an organization or whatever, you can post a sign that says, we do not want concealed weapons on this property. Now, I know the argument with the attorneys would be that that's already the case, because you can post any type of sign, and if somebody violates that sign, you get caught for trespassing. But if this bill goes all the way through, there's going to be a lot of publicity on it, and I'd like to have this amendment in there so the people that are just scared to death of guns, there's folks that are scared to death of insects and folks that are scared to death of snakes. There is a contingent of the population that's scared of guns. They're scared at the sight of them. And I also think it's important that certain businesses have that right. Collection agencies. Possibly a financial institution. That should be up to their board. Will they feel uncomfortable if a bunch of people are in wearing guns? Maybe in a fitness center, Would you feel nervous if the old fellow next to you is pumping a bicycle and he's got a loaded gun there kind of just strapped onto a belt and you're fearful it might fall off? So I just know that a lot of people have that concern. And so with that, I would ask for your favorable consideration on this amendment.
Representative Gingrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would urge you to vote no on this amendment. Property rights are, of course, important, but property rights under our law never trump our personal rights. A company, and where this comes up a lot, is where companies will prohibit you from having a firearm or a gun in a parking lot. And so you go to work, perhaps you leave your gun in your car, and they prohibit that. The argument used is a company cannot prohibit you. They can't tell you you don't have the freedom of speech. They can't tell you you don't have the freedom of religion. What gives the company the right to tell you you cannot have the right to bear arms when you're in their parking lot? I would urge you to vote against this amendment.
Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, would urge you to vote against this amendment. This extends over already into statute with carrying concealed, so I really do not want to mix the two issues. This bill is very different. I'm sorry, carrying with a permit. This bill is very different, and so for that reason, I urge you to vote against this amendment.
Representative Zwanzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hey, and I do appreciate those arguments and those comments. But just let me remind you that some people are extremely nervous about this situation. And I have the feeling that a lot of people are wanting to put themselves in the feet of law enforcement. They're going to carry a gun now, hoping something happens at a financial institution, hoping something happens at a 7-Eleven. And do these people have training of how to handle a gun? And I think it should be the property owner's right to say, wow, you know, I know you might protect our bank employees, but you might end up shooting six customers because when you pull that gun out of your back pocket, you might just not have the very good aim that trained law enforcement officers have. So with that, I will leave it up to the body. Thank you very much.
Do I have a question? All those in favor of the committee of the whole, committee of the whole amendment number two, please say aye. All those opposed, say no. The committee of the whole amendment number two has failed. We are back on the bill. Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move committee of the whole reading number three to House Bill 113. Amendment number three basically says that law enforcement, if they find that you have an alcohol content of 0.08 or more, that they're able to make an arrest. Basically, if they see you walking down the street, they have that ability to remove that concealed firearm from you. Thank you.
Representative Gingrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would urge you to vote no on this. Let me just explain to you the structure of how these statutes look in the statutes. The present law for concealed weapon permit, so you go in and get a permit, it has a list of things that you cannot do. You can't be a felon. You can't be incompetent. You can't be in a mental institution. So there's a list. And all we did, so here's concealed weapon permitting. Here's concealed weapon without a permit. We took the same exact prohibitions and put them into the without a permit, with the exception of the training one. That's the one we took out. By doing this, now you're suddenly adding an extra requirement for people with a concealed weapon no permit, as opposed to a person with a concealed weapon with a permit. We've had concealed weapon permitting for years. This has not been part of it, and we have not had a problem. Why suddenly do we think we have a problem with people intoxicated carrying guns? If we haven't had a problem, I'm not sure why this seems to be something looking for a problem. I would urge you to vote no.
Do I hear the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3 has failed. We are back on the bill. Question having been called.
Chairman.
Representative Stepson.
Mr. Chairman, just one final question for the sponsor. You know, in looking through the current structure of the permit for concealed weapons, there's the provision that requires you to be trained and actually know what you're doing with a gun, and that has been left out of this bill. And I just, what's the logic behind that? If it has made sense in the past, why don't we have in there just that in order to have to carry a concealed weapon, you should have attended a certified class or something like that?
Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I live in a certain part of the state that may be different from all yours, and I respect your opinion on this matter. But I do hunt and I do fish, and I do respect the values of sportsman values of safety. You know, we require everyone that hunts in this state to get a hunter safety card and go through that, and you got to have it when you're hunting. I think there's good sense. I think that's to save lives, and I think if this bill passes and we don't thoroughly vet it, I think it's sad, I guess I'll say this, that there's an assumption that we live in Wyoming and this bill is just going to get a pass, and that's the comment that I've got. And to me, it'll be a sad day if this bill passes, and I respect the opinions of people that really want the rights, but we're also talking about people's lives here. And I guess I'd have a question. What are people so afraid of? Do we live in a society now that we all feel like we need to carry a concealed weapon in this state to defend ourselves, that we don't trust our neighbors? You know, and I guess it'll be a sadder day, and I can't live with this on my conscience as a representative. The day we have an issue with this, whether it be in a school or a church, I just can't. I'm not going to do it, and I urge you to vote no on this bill.
Representative Patton, I really do know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really fascinated with the legal position that this is an absolute right. We're told how law officers are going to look at it. We're not talking about law officers only. You want to look at something, look down the barrel of a gun. That person will have a right to point that gun right directly at your nozzle. Is that the right that we want to grant? How many years has it taken for us to understand that some of the constitutional rights are not absolute? Somebody has to be reasonable in this. I received a letter from an attorney, a former senator. He said, John, those who support this type of legislation apparently believe the Second Amendment affords absolute rights. That is not the case. But I'm sure that any attempt on my or your part will fall on deaf ears. We have a freedom of speech, but you can't holler fire in a crowded room. Why not? Because it's not socially acceptable, because it endangers people. My wife doesn't carry a gun. She doesn't want to carry a gun. And I don't want her to try and be in the position of having to defend herself with a gun because you interpret absolute rights. They're not absolute rights. We're trying to live together. This is a great community and a great state. I have never seen the need, even in hostile environments, to settle an argument as Hamilton found his case. We all quote the Constitution and quote the forefathers and whatnot, but they outlawed dueling. And here we are talking about an absolute right of being able to carry concealed weapons, as though that were a right. You've turned down an amendment that made some limitations to it. You turned down the second one, you can even be drunk and carry a weapon. How many arguments have we seen settled by firearms instead of by legitimate, real conversation? Can't we consolidate? Can't we be people? Can't we be civilized and state a civilized case? I think we can, and we can do so by having the responsibility of the social responsibility that the current laws have developed us to be. And to do that, all you have to do is to vote no. I know it's not popular. 500-plus messages on my machine tell me that it's no. They were already collecting funds to defeat me at the next election. Boy, I'll tell you, if that's the price, and you vote no, and they vote me out, that's a winner, I'll tell you. Please vote no.
Is there any more discussion on the bill? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, ladies and gentlemen, I think a lot of these arguments, although I give great deference and respect to them, I think some of them are not exactly on point. No one is saying that this is an absolute right. In the statutes, you already, if you are concealed carry under 108T, you can't go into the church, you can't carry into the school. But none of that's going to change. I heard the argument about whether a police officer could still frisk somebody if the person said, no, I don't have a concealed weapon. If the officer still has a reasonable suspicion, they can still frisk, pat down, and even detain them in their patrol car because of officer safety and the exigent circumstance of the person being in a vehicle. I think we've got it backwards here. The people we need to be afraid of are the people that don't have permits now anyway. They don't obey the law, and when we say there's a right to free speech, but we can't yell fire in a theater. That's a pretty obvious reason why you can't do that. But if you and I were outside on the public street and I had a concealed weapon, but I don't have a permit, what's my danger to you? You can't assume that I'm a danger to you, but you can assume that if somebody yells fire in a crowded theater, that's obvious that's a problem. But we got to stop assuming that people that carry concealed weapons that under this new law wouldn't have to have a permit, that they're somehow dangerous, they're going to somehow be vigilantes and saunter into the 7 or the convenience store and just look for a situation where they can defend somebody. I submit that that's not realistic. And so I guess I would tell you that those protections are still in place, that are in place under the law now, and we're looking at this backwards. We need to protect the rights of the law-abiding citizens in this state. Thank you.
Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've talked a lot this afternoon about being concerned about the rights of the citizens of the state. Well, I'm here to tell you that I am one of those citizens, and who is going to protect me with this kind of legislation? We all know that we have people out there committing crimes by shooting people in the mall. We've seen it in the schoolrooms. We've seen it in our universities. We've seen them killing in the post offices. This is just another step to give people the idea that lawlessness is okay. And I don't believe that this is what we want to say. And I certainly am opposed to this bill.
Is there any more discussion on the bill? Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hail back to a different age, I guess, when the good representative from Recluse and the good representative from Cheyenne and I all went to high school together, and the gun racks were all full in the back of the pickup, and seems as though we didn't have any more gun violence then than we do now. Look at the situation of the law. To get a concealed carry permit is a piece of paper, $60, and a background check that says you haven't committed any crimes. What is the difference between what this bill does and what we're doing now, which is a piece of paper, $60, and a background check? People own guns in this state. All kinds of people own guns in this state. People carry guns in this state. All kinds of people carry guns in this state. Having a piece of paper that's granted to you from the sheriff isn't going to make one whit of difference in the existence of that crime. And so, and if you think it is, think through that fiction that you have in your mind that that piece of paper is going to make a difference. We have the opportunity sometimes to look through the shields and the bureaucracy and the paperwork that we create for ourselves to go home and feel good. And this is one of those bills, because it looks through that that piece of paper and that $60 and that background check doesn't make a bit of difference. This says that. This says, let's just agree with reality. Let's treat reality the way reality is. And let's let people, let's not make criminals out of law-abiding citizens.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Gingrey's motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill 113 do pass. Say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Division has been called. Okay, go ahead. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed? All right. House Bill 113 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 11. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 11, introduced by Representative Escobel, an act relating to the Wyoming Cancer Control Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Harvey, Kimball, Landon, No, Shepperson, excused, Hallinan, and Millen. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 111 or 1. House Bill 11, do pass. I further move standing committee. Oh, there is not a standing committee amendment. That's a committee of the whole amendment. I just move the bill, and I turn over the explanation of the bill.
There is a standing committee.
Oh, okay. I further move standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 11, and I will explain that. Primarily, what this bill does is take the appropriation that is included in the bill from the general fund and places it in the Tobacco Settlement Trust Fund. And if there's no questions about that, I'd call for the question.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would yield the explanation of the bill to the good representative from the great city of Cheyenne.
Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring to you House Bill 11. I did put a handout out there that shows the deaths in the state of Wyoming due to colorectal cancer, and those are actually Medicaid deaths. So we found it better to be proactive rather than reactive, to give the treatment for one person going through colorectal cancer would be more than this entire appropriation. House Bill 11 is the only House bill that actually will take some money out of that tobacco trust settlement income account. And at present, there's $2.4 million in there. At this time, I'd like to move a Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 11. And what that does is it changes more frequent to follow-up. We felt as though since this was an amendment to an act that passed in 2007, that we were limited in it to individuals who've had a prior screening. So wherever you see more frequent, you'll see follow-up screenings. Those would probably happen between 3 to 5 years. It'd be on a case-to-case basis. It would be up to the medical directors looking at each individual case as whether or not they were in need of a rescreening. And that pretty much is the bill. I'll call for the question if there aren't any questions.
Question has been called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The amendment has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Escobel.
You're up next.
Oh. Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Assuming that the sponsor has had his chance to explain the bill, I don't really feel real strong about it, but I think that we need to take a look at where we are on this responsibility that the state has to, sponsor all of these, underwrite these costs. I would think that if there was a signal in a test that somebody got that indicated that you need to take another test here pretty soon to make sure that this isn't a serious problem, that I think they would have the ability to, and the wherewithal to gather up the money to test the second time. I think the state has a responsibility, is going really beyond their responsibility to help them discover the first, through the first test. But just continuing test after test, it was already reported during the introduction of the bill that we're already doing the most of any other state, and now we want to do more. And the economics of saving money by doing this is just not tenable. I mean, if there was a cancer, it could be a cancer anyway, and then we'd still be responsible for paying for it. So it's not a savings in the sense that you might think.
Is there any more discussion on the bill? Do I have a question? Oh, sorry. Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On and against the bill, and we heard a lot of good testimony about all the reasons that we should do this. But like the good previous speaker said, where do you draw the line? We screen for some of them. We don't screen for some of them. We screen once for some of them. Do we screen twice for some of them now? It's just a slippery slope that we keep falling further and further and further down. And pretty soon, we're going to be screening everybody for every known type of cancer that there is. Do we know that cancer is bad? Yes. Do we know that early screening can prevent it? Yes. But again, is it the state's responsibility to do this? And so I'd really encourage the body to think about this. This is a policy decision that we really need to decide which way we're going to go. Thank you.
Representative Escobel.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly why I do bring this legislation, because we have a fiscal responsibility to the citizens of the state of Wyoming. If an individual already knows that he's had a bad screening and he can't go through this program, he'll go to his doctor. He'll pay twice as much because the providers that are in this program give the state those screenings for 50%. They write off their cost. So that person would then be subject to taking that money out of his own bank account. In my case, I guess that'd be looking at three house payments. The other concern is, yeah, we can not screen them. We can let them go into Medicaid for treatment. And at that point, then I guess we'll be paying millions of dollars. So that's where I think it is the fiscally sound. It's based on national guidelines. It's based on a very easy procedure. And that's why we don't want to go. It is kind of a slippery slope, I guess, when you wake up in the morning and you look in the John and all of a sudden you see a bunch of blood in there. You don't want to wait till that point. It's too late then. So, hate to be a little graphic, Mr. Chairman, but I call for the question.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Representative Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 11 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please stand. House Bill 11 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 77. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 77, introduced by Representative Byrd. An act relating to game and fish regarding youth archery licenses. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, Millen, Jefferson, Thompson. Excused, Childers. Signed, Representative Brown, Vice Chair. The bill was further referred to Appropriations, which respectfully reports same back to the House that it be do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart. Excused, Philp.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Childers?
I move when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that bill number 77 do pass. And I will turn the floor over to the good representative from Cheyenne to cover the bill.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I bring before you House Bill 77. I hope it's not too controversial. It is youth archery permit reduction in fees for youth archers. I'll be fairly brief here. It addresses one thing, and that is the youth archers are being currently assessed the adult fee to go into the special bow hunting season. Keeping in mind that to go hunting, they have to first purchase the complete adult tag so that they can be able to hunt. The tag and the fee reduction in question here is the one only concerned with the bow season, and it is a reduction to $6. For your information, there is a fiscal note attached. Game and Fish has looked at this. They are okay with that. Based on the amount of licenses, we think that we're going to increase sales by having more hunters out in the field. It appears that it just might be revenue neutral.
The other good thing is about this, I've been told by many of the parents who are parents of bow hunters that now that they don't have to choose between a son or a daughter to take them out into the field, they can usually take both of them now. So at this point, I don't see any real controversy here. It is a great thing to help enhance the next generation of bow hunters in this state, and I stand for questions.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Childers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 77 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 77 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Representative Anderson? Okay, the next bill for our consideration is House Bill 115. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 115, introduced by Representative Buchanan, an act relating to taxation and revenue, specific purpose, excise tax voter petition. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson. No, Anderson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 115 do pass, and I'll turn. There are no standing committee amendments, and I don't think there's any Committee of the Whole amendments, and I'll turn over the explanation of the bill to the good representative from House District 4.
Representative Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring for your favorable consideration House Bill 115. We talked about this on introduction. It deals with the specific purpose excise tax, and what it does is the bill allows for that tax, if people want it, to be placed on the ballot by petition. Currently, under 3916204, you've got the option for general revenue, specific purpose, and economic development. General revenue and economic development, you can put it on two ways. You can put it on with two-thirds incorporated municipalities, a resolution from two-thirds, or you can put it on with a petition consisting of 5% of the electors of the county. And you'll see that on page 2 of the bill, lines 13 and 16, that's the language we're adding. And up above that, you can see in current law the two-thirds of the incorporated municipalities. So we're adding the ability for people to petition to place this on the ballot, and the same thing is on page 3. It's the exact same language. One is for chapter 15 for sales tax, 16 is for the use tax. The reason for the bill is simply to allow the people to have the power to petition for the specific purpose tax, just like they do now if they want to tax themselves for economic development and for general revenue. Normally, I consider tax to be a four-letter word, but in this case, it really is a three-letter word because the people at the local level will have the ability to put this on the ballot themselves. They have the ability to explain to their fellow voters and citizens what it is they want to fund for specific purpose, just like for economic development, just like for general revenue, and then they all get to vote on it at the general election. So I just wanted to add this provision in there because a lot of times if a constituency wants a specific purpose tax, they're sometimes held hostage by other communities, especially in those counties where you may have just one or two incorporated municipalities. When you need two-thirds and you only have two, you need 100%. So that's the reason for the bill. I stand for any questions.
Question being called.
All those in favor? What? Oh, excuse me, Representative Gendry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few explanations of, in my county, we're the only county in the state, actually, we only have one municipality. So whenever we do the SPET ballot, special excise tax ballot, we have to get the town to agree with the county. And it actually turns into a very nice process. We do it together, the commissioners and the council sit as one body, and they take applications. In our town, in our county, the SPET ballot actually never lapses. As soon as it starts to look like we've almost paid off the project that we were working on, we immediately go to the ballot again before it runs out, so that in our town it's a sixth penny. That sixth penny never actually ends because it's always getting renewed. Because the SPET has become extremely popular in our community because it funds so many projects. The problem is that determining which projects to do, and what we do in our community is we try to do it for 3 years. We bring in about $10 million a year on a penny, so we do $30 million worth of projects. When every time they open this up to applications, you know, you get about $60 million worth of applications. You got to narrow it down to 30, meaning that's all you're going to put on the ballot is $30 million worth. So the tax will be only in effect for the next 3 years. The difficulty is that many people come forward with projects that are not legally permissible. Let me give an example. Right now we're going through this process in my county. Some people came forward with the idea of building this boat ramp on the Snake River. The problem is we don't own the land. The Army Corps of Engineer would have to grant quite a few different permitting aspects. It's legally not going to work. Another example, there's an application for to fund a corpus for a fund to buy conservation easements. Again, there's some serious legal problems with it. There's another application to fund energy conservation in private homes. There's some huge issues in regards to the Wyoming Constitution as to that issue. So you have these applications that have huge legal problems. By allowing the county and the town to sit as one, they can weed out the projects that A, have legal problems and just are not going to work, or B, just are policy-wise not smart investments for the community. What happens is people don't always understand that. They get very excited. It sounds like a great idea. Let's make a boat ramp. You know, I have a boat. I'd like to stick my boat in the Snake River. That boat ramp's not going too well. You know, it's getting old. Let's build a new one there. So everybody signs the petition. All of a sudden, it's on the ballot that gets passed. All of a sudden, money's being collected for a project that we have no control over. We don't own the land. So I think it works really well allowing the counties and the towns to talk these through, go through a process. The problem appears to be with some of these communities, with the towns holding the county hostage. What we need to do is maybe tinker with whether or not to allow the towns to have a voice, or maybe reducing that percentage. But allowing this straight to the ballot issue without going through a vetting process of some sort, you're going to have, I think, a real mess.
Is there any more discussion on the bill? Representative Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On top of the problems that were just illustrated, it seems that the 5% bar is an awfully low bar, that any of those special interest groups specified could gather 5% signatures. And then I guess what it seems like that we want the referendum process to be to give us some indication really of how the people feel. We have a fairly high referendum standard for state initiatives. And I just would think that you could almost have this happen year after year after year and not really have a good indication that a majority of the people in the county might likely support it because there's such a low bar of signatures in here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to address some of the questions or statements
by the good representative from House District 23. I think that in any case, it's incumbent upon the county clerk and the county attorney who handles the civil legal matters for the county to consult on these things to make sure that a particular project is not going to be illegal. The same things apply to some of the other local option taxes. Same thing applies to the issuance of catering permits. There's only so many of them allowed. There are only so many of them allowed at a certain place. The county clerk has to kind of police that to make sure when people apply for things, they want to do things, that they're within the law. And that's why they have a county attorney to advise them. And I'm glad that it works very well in Teton County, currently the way it is. But I also don't see anything wrong with allowing the people themselves to petition for projects they want. And that leads me into to comment on the good representative from House District 30's comment as far as is the 5% a big enough threshold. Well, you know, we put that in the law, and we could certainly raise that. But the fact of the matter is that's been the law with regard to general revenue and economic development for a number of years. And you have to remember, if you want to talk about whether or not a majority of the people want this, the 5% is only to put it on the ballot. You're going to have your majority vote at the general election on the issue itself. And I have the numbers for what 5% of the electors of the county would be for each county. And it's not very easy, I would not think, to get the number of signatures. 5%, I would submit, is more than you think. So stand for more questions.
Representative McComey.
Well, thank you. I'm on and for the bill. This is what this is all about, folks, allowing you to have a voice as an individual, and then the majority of the people in that county have to vote for it. So I think it's another option that's been sorely needed. I live in a county where there's 6 municipalities in the county government.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. Is the 5%, would that prevent or preclude the, in our case, the 5 communities from voicing their opinion relative to either the 1 cent or the capital tax? If that is the move, why that in our county we've been doing it for years, and for the capital tax there is a list of the capital projects that we're going to do, and it doesn't expire until those capital projects are completed, and then if they want to extend it, they have to come forward with the list again. And if this is going to preclude the elected representatives, in our case, of our 5 communities, doesn't sound like it's very healthy for us in the North.
Representative Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can answer that question directly. This will not preclude the incorporated municipalities and their elected bodies from doing what they've done in the past. There's still going to be the option of getting a resolution from 2/3 of the incorporated municipalities to place this on the ballot, regardless of whether or not there's a petition that I'm seeking through this bill. Thank you.
Is there any additional discussion? Representative Patton.
With that assurance, then I would assume that the 2/3 or the 5% would be in addition to the other 5 mills that you have available.
Is there any additional discussion? Do I hear a call for the question? Question being called for. All those in favor of Representative Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number 115 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
The chair is in doubt. Please, all those in favor, please stand. House Bill 115 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 102. The clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 102 introduced by House Bill 102 introduced by Representative Anderson, an act relating to livestock and brands. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Swanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Semlek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill Number 102 passes, and I turn the explanation of the bill over to the good Chairman of the Revenue Committee from District 10.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This has to do with branding, brand inspections. Nobody brands a goat, llama, or an alpaca, so it's not a brand inspection as such, but it doesn't. They are now required by law to be inspected. It costs the livestock board money to do it. It doesn't accomplish anything. Sometimes they can count them, and sometimes they don't count them right. And the growers don't want it. The livestock board doesn't want it. The only catch in it is about predator control, and there's a portion in the bill that says the goat raisers can voluntarily pay that predator control, and then they'll be subject to that control and be able to serve on those predator control boards if they've paid their dues on those. Some of the question was asked, well, what if they don't tell the truth about voluntarily paying? And my answer to that is goat herders are honest, maybe not sheep herders.
Is there any more discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Semlek's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill 102 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Bill 102 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for... Yes, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
You guys want to keep going? Is that what you're saying? All those in favor? No. Can't do it. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye. All those opposed, say no.
No!
The ayes have it. Technically, they did vote that down.
Yeah.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 106, amended, recommended, do pass. House Joint Resolution Number 9, amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 72, amended and further amended. And further amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 86, amended and recommended, do pass. House Bill 69, recommended, do pass. House Bill 70, amended and further amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 124, recommended, do pass. House Bill 93, recommended, do pass. House Bill 113, amended and further amended. Recommended, do pass. House Bill 11, amended and further amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 77, recommended, do pass. House Bill 115, recommended, do pass. House Bill 102, recommended, do pass. Signed, Representative Byrd, Chairman.
Representative Byrd.
I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Thank you, Representative Byrd. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Standing committee. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 34. Recommend that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Galloway, Kimball, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed, representing Galloway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 39, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Kimball, Miller, Zwanitzer, Dan, no, Illaway, Lubno, Stubson, sign representing Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 128, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Illaway, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, no, Hales, Kimball. Signed, represent Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 4 engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Kimball, Lubno, Miller, Stepson, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, representing Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 5 engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Kimball, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, excused, Lubno, sign representing Illaway, Chairman.
We are at that order of business of Senate files on first reading. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 36.
Senate File 36, introduced by Senator Hines.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to water development, the Gillette-Madison Water Project.
Senate File 36 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 62.
Senate File 62, introduced by Senator Bebout.
First reading of the bill.
An act regarding veterans' burial.
Senate File 62 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 69.
Senate File 69, introduced by the Natural Resources Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Wyoming Wildlife and Natural Resource Large Project Funding.
Senate File 69 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 72.
Senate File 72, introduced by the Appropriation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Wyoming Retirement System Plan Contributions.
Senate File 72 is referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Committee announcements. Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet Friday the 19th upon recess at noon in room H10 to discuss the two bills, Senate File 41, Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program, and Senate File 42, School Finance Student Enrichment Instruction.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet Friday morning at 8 a.m. in room H10 to consider the following bills. Senate File 10, Engrossed, State Parks, Bear River State Park. Senate File 11, State Parks Acquisition and Disposition of Lands. State Park, or Senate File 12, Engrossed, State Parks and Historic Sites, Boundaries and Designations.
Chairman Gingrey. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number one, Judiciary, I announced at noon that we were going to be meeting tomorrow morning to hear DUI and medical support of children. We have canceled that meeting. So, House Judiciary members, we will not be meeting tomorrow morning. Instead, if you're looking for something to do, the Senate Judiciary is taking up quite a few of our bills first thing in the morning. So if you'd like to wander down there and help defend some of our bills, it would be appreciated.
Chairman Anderson.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number three, Revenue, will not meet tomorrow morning.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, will meet tomorrow upon noon recess in H-17 to hear Senate File 23, Engrossed Unemployment Compensation Amendments, and Senate File 24, Community-Based In-Home Services.
Chairman Lockhart, re-referral.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to re-refer House Bill 79, Eminent Domain Wind Power Collector Lines, to Appropriations Committee number 2.
Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8 on Highways, Transportation, and Military Affairs will meet in 10 minutes today, February 18th, in room H-17 to discuss House Bill 81, Safe Transportation of Railroad Employees, and House Bill 73, Safety on Railroads.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet upon adjournment to hear re-referred bill, House Bill 79.
Any other announcements? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I know you all have become spoiled, but I did not have time to type out your general file today. But you have plenty to work on. What's left on the list, and then you can add House Bills 91, 97, 120, 122, 79, 63, 80, 111, 54, 89, 132, 114, and House Joint Resolution 10, and other bills that may be added at my discretion. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until Friday, February 19, 2010, at 9 a.m.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye. All those opposed, no. The House is in recess until Friday, February 19th at 9 a.m.